Tonight on The Download, the Monday evening quarterback with Bears insider Adam Hogue. One of Chicago's best mixologists from Logan Square's Scofflaw, Danny Shapiro. And live holiday music from the Roots country band Big Sadie. Now, here's your host, a man who hopes the Star Wars will end soon, Justin Kaufman. Who's the man? Who's the man?
Just so much fighting, Pete. So many Star Wars. Just hope it ends soon. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you until 11 o'clock tonight, kicking off this week, our last week here before, of course, before the big holidays, but the last week of 2017 for the crew, as we'll be off after Christmas. But we got a great show lined up tonight. We got a couple shows this week, even though there's some Blackhawks and Northwestern basketball and all the like. But we're starting off strong tonight with a four-hour jamboree, and a jamboree it is. Big Sadie's back in the building. Big Sadie, great country American roots band. They got fiddles. That's all that matters. They were in here back in May, and they performed live. They're awesome, and they are going to be in studio at Studio 435 tonight doing Christmas music, holiday Christmas music, which, you know, I can only hope that they'll bring us a Children Go where I Send Thee. You know, in my honor, you know, they'll bring that one back. Pete, I saw Star Wars this week. I know you're a big Star Wars guy.
That came out?
That came out, yeah. I have a great story where I tricked my 10-year-old, where I didn't let him know that we were going to see the movie. And Adam, who was in town all week... Adam Witt, of course, from Schadenfreude, does a lot of stuff with the show, and he'll be around. He came in for Force Awakens 2 years ago, and it became like a thing. So it's his, you know, his godparents kind of thing.
Yeah,
they all were into their, it's like nerd family. And so this year I did this whole thing, man. I did this whole thing where I was like, oh, you know, they just couldn't make it. I mean, Adam just not going to be able to make it this year. He's poor. He's not going to make it. He can't fly back to Chicago. Sorry.
You're crushing.
Yeah, I'm crushing, right? And Star Wars is sold out till mid-January, maybe Valentine's Day, maybe March. I don't know what to say, buddy. You know, sorry, we didn't think about this. So anyway, my wife and I were like, we told him we were going to Sur La Table to get a corkscrew, wine screw, which is, you know, like the specific thing. And we drove over to the Arclight, and we walked in the theater, and he did such a good job. My wife was like, oh, dude, I don't think this is the right door, you know? And then my son walks in, and he's like, oh, yeah, I don't think this is a theater. And he turns to me, and he's like, hey, Dad, you know, look, Star Wars is on the marquee, you know? Oh, sure we can't just see it? And I'm like, nah, we can't. And then Adam showed up, and he had a Kylo Ren mask on.
In the theater, waiting.
In the lobby,
great.
And he showed up like almost like a street vendor from Hollywood Boulevard, you know, where you're like, don't touch him. And I love Miles because he couldn't tell that it was his Uncle Adam because he had the mask on. And so Adam was like, what's your name? And he's like, I ain't telling you. Like, he had a real Stranger Danger vibe to it that was like, I don't know what's happening here. And then he pulled the mask off, and then it was a jamboree.
Ah, that is great.
But the best part is he got to see that his Uncle Adam was there, which was awesome. But then the best part is that he still didn't put two and two together that
he was
there for
the
Star Wars.
Yeah. Oh.
So he's like, well, so what are we doing? Are we going
to go back to get the corkscrew?
Yeah. Are we going to get that corkscrew? So it's a fun event to do that on opening weekend and trick him. Second trick. I got him on the Harry Potter play earlier this week. And then someone called out of the group. They're like, so you're essentially lying to your children. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Just think about the next time, though, you're going to CVS. He's going to be looking around thinking, oh, what cool thing am I going to do? And then you're just going to get toothpaste
and go home. The expectations are too high. That's my fear, too. And I also, I keep thinking in my head, I'm like, well, hopefully this will score some cool points. So when he's, you know, in his terrible teens and he's 17 years old and he's like, I hate you, Dad. I'm like, oh, yeah, well, who tricked you to see Star Wars?
He won't remember.
Who did that?
Or care.
Yeah. That's too bad. Anyway.
He'll probably still be seeing Star Wars and tricking him up when he's in his terrible teens. Because there's new ones coming out forever, right?
There's so many Star Wars. It's just, you can't stop. There's so many Star Wars. And it's just wars after war after war.
in the stars.
The one thing I will say, and you'll like this, Pete, and this is a little bit of a spoiler alert, and okay. I know a lot of people haven't seen it. I don't want to make a big deal about it. There is a shirtless driver.
Oh.
A shirtless Adam driver.
Oh, a shirtless Adam driver.
Yeah. I'm just letting you know.
All right.
You know, I know you're into that kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
the I was a big fan of him. Yeah.
And you like girls, and mm-hmm. he's usually shirtless. And they brought that part of his acting chops to the Star Wars franchise. If he starts woodworking and doing push-ups and Lena Dunham's there, then we're in trouble. Then we know that it's like Star Wars 10 is going to be a very cerebral experience. So coming up tonight, we got a lot of great stuff. Touché's coming up. This will be the final Touché of 2017. And so the big question I have for both Dave Lundy and Chris Varonis is, who won? Democrats or Republicans? Hash it out. Who were the victors in the race for politics 2017? We'll see. Dave Lundy and Chris Varonis probably have a lot of opinions on that. So we'll talk with them about that coming up here at 7:37. 8 o'clock, of course, I guess we have to talk about the Bears. The Monday Evening Quarterback with Adam Hoge, which is a great segment, and he's amazing, and he breaks down because he watches the tape, and he really gets into the specifics and the nuances of this game, which I did not see. I saw nothing. Did you watch the game?
I did.
Miserable. It was a miserable game.
Yeah.
Like, the first half, I don't think I made a sound. I was, like, inaudible
yeah,
on my couch.
Yeah,
like,
It was so boring.
It was so boring. They were terrible. Like, you were just like, there's not even anything. The defense isn't good. The offense is terrible. Trubisky is terrible. Like, everything about it, you were just like, this is so uninspired.
I go through, for the segment, I go through the highlights of the game that they put up on the NFL network or NFL.com or whatever. And the big Bears highlight was, besides the one touchdown, was a 12-yard pass to Kendall Wright. That was it. That was it.
Yeah, so that's ridiculous.
And then you watch the Steelers and the Patriots, and you're like, that.
Any game.
You
we
can
were
see
watching
why
the,
like,
yeah,
people
Raiders
like football.
And Cowboys, where you're like, oh, this is really interesting. Yeah. The way they're down to like an inch and a fourth and one and everything. But yeah, the Bears, you're like, yeah, this is how you get people to not show up at Soldier Field on Christmas Eve.
You're exactly right. I don't think I made one sound.
I know. It was halftime, and I'm like, I think that was the first sound I made. I got to get up off this couch. It's a terrible game. Yeah. Terrible. I mean, it was a national game, right? It was Saturday.
Yeah.
Everybody got that game. And this is what the Bears showed the country, the improvement of their prized rookie and the development of this team from, you know, they may have a losing record, but they play tough. No, they don't. Nope. None of that stuff counts with the Chicago Bears. So we'll talk with Adam Hoge coming up at 8 o'clock, 312-981-7200. And in the 9 o'clock hour, Danny Shapiro is going to be here. Great bartender, bar beverage director, mixologist, whatever you want to call him. He's one of the guys behind, the brainchild behind Scofflaw in Logan Square. He's got a new bar called Moonlighter. We'll talk about the evolution of the craft cocktail bar in the city of Chicago and in the neighborhood Logan Square. I mean, that Scofflaw opened in 2012.
I just was at Moonlighter.
Were you?
Yeah, like last week. I didn't even know it was connected.
Yep, that's his new place.
Yeah.
So come
nice.
In and talk. Well, good. You can ask him a couple questions about it.
It's decorated for Christmas, up to my standards.
Up to standards.
Had a lot of games on TVs. Terrific service.
There you go.
Huh.
See?
Look at
You're
that.
Doing the prep. It's prep. Pete did some prep. We'll talk with Danny Shapiro coming up in the Industry Night segment. And Scott Smith's going to be here, our new media contributor. Our newer media contributor. We'll talk about the stories to look forward to and whether or not in 2018, and whether or not the digital bubble, the digital news bubble is about to bust. We saw with DNA Info and Chicagoist and some of the other digital-only news providers go belly up this year. And the question, and there's been a couple articles out there just about whether or not that is going to be a huge trend in 2018 as the business model has just not worked out. We'll also talk about social media crackdowns, Twitter, and how Facebook admitted that the social media giant makes people depressed. What? I'd be okay with paying $5 a month for something that doesn't make me depressed. You know, like, yeah, it's a free product, but it also messes with your chemistry. So we'll talk about that. So big show tonight. So let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those
who know it well. All right, we'll come back, do the carryout. Stay with us. Hits the download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. It's time for the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news so you at home, you don't have to. All right, here are today's top stories. Comptroller Susana Mendoza is calling out Governor Rauner for not being man enough to take her on. I'm trying to figure that quote out. I'm not sure what she's going with here, but she said that Rauner can't handle criticism from a 5'3" woman from Chicago, which, let's be honest, not many of us can. But there's something to be said that Mendoza continues to get under the governor's skin. For as much as he tries to ignore her or try to call her out for being a crony of Mike Madigan, it just doesn't faze her. So that could be fun to watch coming up here in the election season. And again, I wouldn't mess with Susana Mendoza. She seems like the type of Chicagoan that's going to get up in your face if you take a parking spot you didn't shovel out. You know what I mean? I'd be all passive-aggressive about it, mumbling under my breath, but not Mendoza. She'd be rapping on the side of the window, "Get out of the car!" That's what you want out of the Illinois comptroller. A scream, "Get out of the car!" President Trump told us we were going to win national security today. I didn't hear the speech. How many times did he reference the election? Used the word "very," and then used the phrase "the likes of which we've never seen." Oh, he did all three? Great. I got bingo. Awesome. And now it's time for the new download segment, Loophole. President Trump's lawyers are suggesting that Robert Mueller illegally obtained Trump transition emails. What does that even mean? He's the investigator, right? There's no illegal obtaining. He's the legal in this legal argument. Are we to believe that the special prosecutor can look at some emails, but not others? I mean, did he not use the right form online? What are we talking about here? Did he not leave a note when he took him off Carl's desk? Illegally obtained. Actually, we should call this segment "Look Over Here Instead." That's what's happening. Yeah, so UFOs are heating up again. If there wasn't enough evidence that we were reverting back to the 80s, what's next, Max Headroom? It was revealed that the Pentagon has a secret UFO investigation going on, and now pilots and other witnesses are coming forward to tell stories of contact. Oh, I see what's happening here. It's another Star Wars tie-in, isn't it? Grapes, diapers, and now the news? Come on, I get it. Great. Go see Star Wars before the Death Star shoots down New Mexico. We get it. I did give the spoiler a little bit earlier. Ladies, some guys, there's a shirtless Adam Driver. I don't think that that's too much of a giveaway. A federal appeals judge resigned quickly today when allegations emerged of sexual harassment. When asked about it, he was like, "I mean, come on, look at me." Gosh, that guy has all the sexual appeal of a federal appeals judge. He really does. Such a good look. Check that guy's look out on Google. You're like, "Oh, that guy." The head of ESPN is stepping down because of substance abuse addiction. Really? That's new. Oh, good. He's just hurting himself and his loved ones. Not everybody else. Look what they've done to us, Pete. We got all I'm callous. Oh, good. Substance abuse. That's not so bad. Famed local bankruptcy lawyer Peter Francis Geraci lost his court case against a former employer. He spent 7 years and $90 million on the case. 7 years and $90 million. Jeez, who represented him? Does Geraci have to call a different late-night lawyer? One that advertises on the Goldbergs? Are you a bankruptcy lawyer going through bankruptcy? Hi, I can help. I'm Justin Kaufman. In weather, I don't know, it's dark out. And AAA is reminding us there's going to be traffic this year, worse than ever. Except, you know, rush hour every day. Right? It's all the same. In sports, the Bears took a national spotlight game and just ruined it for all fans by putting in yet another uninspiring loss. I don't even want to put any emotion into this one. Instead, you know what? I'm going to put the show on autopilot and let Talk Show Robot give you the breakdown while I go get some dinner. Talk Show Robot?
Thank you. The Bears lost to the Lions 20-10. The play of Mitchell Trubisky was terrible. Best player on Bears was recalculating. No one. Bears are now 4-10. Sad emoji.
There you go. Talk show robot. Thank you, talk show robot. I'm not even going to spend any more time on this. We'll do it in the Monday evening quarterback. Just, let's talk winners for a change, right? The Chicago Blackhawks had everyone talking about a joyless winter when they lost 5 in a row a couple weeks back, and they erased that taste in our mouth by turning around and winning 5 in a row, taking it to the Minnesota Wild last night. The Hawks are now right back in the thick of it with a lot of time left to play. 5 in a row, they look fast. They're making all the right plays. The Stars are playing well. Let's not peak too early. I love last year. Last week we're like, are we panicked? Now I'm like, slow down, slow your roll. Win one, lose one. Win one, lose one. All the way till we get to April. All right. And the Bulls take their 5-game winning streak home to take on the upstart Sixers tonight at UC, going for 6 in a row. 6 in a row would get them to 9-20. What a hole they dug, huh? And they win 5 in a row, and now they're just respectable losers. They're not the worst. They're just respectable. The countdown to mild interest in speed skating has begun. The Winter Olympics start in February, and it's in South Korea, and nobody wants to go. Like, I read this whole article, and they're not selling tickets. Not even the Russians, and they're banned. They just don't want to be a part of it. The Winter Olympics are a hard enough sell. Then you go and you put them in a town that's pretty darn close to the madmen that we continue to poke with a stick. But hey, skeet and shoot. I'll pay $500 for that, or whatever that's called. Yeah. Skeet and shoot. Cubs left fielder Kyle Schwarber has reportedly lost 20 pounds already this offseason in an effort to transform himself into an everyday player. Hey, I'll bet he could lose 5 more pounds if he got rid of that dumb chin beard. Right? I mean, he's 20-something. He's got to have a girlfriend. What's with the color me bad facial hair? Get rid of that, dude. College b-ball, don't look now, but Northwestern's back. They're winning again. They beat up on a good Valpo team last week. They squeaked one out against DePaul this weekend. They're 8-4, all this before the Big Ten games start in early 2018. And finally tonight, Facebook announced they're going to start demoting posts that are just fishing for likes. So the next time you have the urge to say, hey, Facebook, do people like me? Don't do it. Do people like me? Anybody? Come on, likes. One like. Like it. No likes? All right, I'll check back later. That's the carryout for December 18, 2017. Hey, do you want some specialty ketchup? I mean, it's just ketchup mixed with older ketchup, but yeah, secret sauce. All right, here we go. The Touche coming up. Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy will give us the latest in national politics, and we'll talk about whether or not 2017 was a win for the Democrats or Republicans. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, my friend. Yeah. What's going on?
Not much. How was the weekend?
Not too bad. Not too bad at all. Just chilled a little bit. The Aidens, Mite hockey team in Glenview, scored a huge come-from-behind win on Sunday. We were down 5-2 late in the third period. We pulled the goalie, tied the game up, and won it in a shootout.
Oh, yeah! Shootout, and, you know, which is probably the best thing in sport.
And as an assistant coach for the Mite hockey team, my primary responsibility is making sure that the heavy doors are open and closed without smooshing one of the kids. But I do take some pride in the fact that we that they won.
It's good. Those doors were shut properly.
That's right.
That's a good thing. Are you the kind of dad that gets stressed about holiday gift giving? Like, are you like in the thick of it right now?
Not really. I'm pretty much done. You know, I keep it simple these days. For the older ones, it's usually cash or gift cards, so that's pretty easy. And the little ones, they're pretty easy to buy for.
There you go. All right.
Yeah. No, no electronics.
Zen, a little Martyr Zen. I like that.
How about you? You done?
No electronics, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. You done?
I am not done, but I'm close enough.
Okay.
Right, you get to that point. I was saying to Anna, I feel like I procrastinate at this point. Like, I got like 1.5 things to do, and I could have done it today, but I'm like, I'll do it on Friday. I'll do it on Saturday. I'm going to do it with all the masses.
Yeah.
A masses guy, right?
Yeah, I stopped at Target today. It was a madhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. Not really.
Not really.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
All right, time for some touche here in December, the end of 2017. The final touche of the year with Dave Lundy and Chris Varonis in studio as we get ready to argue, push, pull. What are we going to do here tonight? Let's get into it. A lot to talk about. Why don't we start, guys, with the tax plan? It seemed at the middle of last week after we talked, it was on shaky ground. Some senators were saying, you know, we're not going to go that way. Then we get to the weekend, and then we start to see that they turned the vote, but it might have been for personal reasons. What's happening?
Corker kickback, I think you're referring to there, Justin. Senator Bob, I will never vote for this if it adds even one penny to the deficit. Corker suddenly changed his mind at the last minute, and lo and behold, it was discovered that a tax provision was put in place that would benefit those people who had passed through real estate companies. Who might have those? Somebody named Donald and, oh, somebody named Bob Corker apparently might benefit to the tune of millions of dollars. Corker insists, I had no idea. I didn't even know this was in there. And at this point, from my perspective, there are no Republican heroes. There are only Republican hypocrites who've been talking about deficit reduction for years and came up with a horrid bill.
All right, Mr. Varonis.
You know, Dave Lundy.
Yes, Chris Varonis?
Dave Lundy, if you met a black hole, you would suck in the black hole.
I don't even know what that means.
I swear to God. Because nothing escapes your presence. Nothing, including the facts and the truth. I mean, seriously.
Well, I do suck in the facts and the truth, that's why I always spit them out at you in response to your
week.
Like, rhetoric
with these chicken little prophecies about how the country is going to slide off into the ocean. It's ridiculous.
So this is not going to add to our national debt,
but improvements there will be. There, this bill's not perfect.
You acknowledge it will pay for itself.
It will.
That's great progress.
Well, it's a misgiving I have that no one's got the courage to do spending cuts anymore. It's all spending increases and tax cuts, and that's not sustainable over the long term. But, you know, a lot of things that you've said in the past aren't true anymore. You've got a child tax credit that was included. You've got expensing. You've got 62% of Americans who will see a tax cut. You get 8% who will see a mild marginal tax increase. On average, this
as long
is
as you're not the
8%,
that's
this
fine.
This is going to increase jobs. This is about capital formation. We haven't had that in about two decades.
What I've really enjoyed in this debate is that Republicans don't even hide the fact this is just for corporate tax cuts. The goal of this legislation is corporate tax. And yeah, there's a little for the middle class there, but it's about corporations.
Created?
Wealth is created by middle class people spending money into the economy and fueling.
Gosh, I missed that lesson in economics class.
Well, clearly you did miss that lesson.
Yeah.
But no, the fact is that if you look at any economic expansion in recent times, it was created by middle class having more money in their pocket and spending that money in the economy.
Last I checked, Bill
90%
cut
of the benefits.
Capital gains tax.
90% of the benefits of this bill are going to the top 2%.
And more revenues came into the federal government. In the 80s, there is almost $1 trillion in new revenues.
You throw a little carrot. You throw a little mini carrot.
$1 trillion in revenues. Yeah, that's a little
carrot. No, that's mostly going to the corporations and the 1%. 90% of the benefits are going there.
The Treasury Department, Dave. The Treasury Department got $1 trillion in extra revenues in the 80s.
Okay, yeah, and that's why the deficits exploded as they did under George W. Bush when the economy didn't expand with these tax cuts.
You know, Chris has a point in the way that there has been a lot of hysteria around this tax plan, a lot of different areas that were called out by the media that said, oh, this is going to be taken from people, watch out for the mortgage interest. And I think what Chris is saying is that when it all plays out, either that stuff, maybe the hysteria was right in the way that it got people away from the ledge, or it just wasn't true at all.
No, it was 100% true, and the focus on it helped the Republicans move away from things. Like, for example, they restored medical expense deduction, something I've railed about in here. They decided
the adoption tax credit was restored.
Oh, thank God. because that affects so many people in this country compared to
these things in the weeks.
No, the adoption tax credit was not something I was critical of. I was critical of taxing the tuition waivers for graduate students. I was critical of the fact that in high tax states like Illinois and California and New York, those states are going to be killed. Like my best friend in New York, the Trump voter, is going to be killed because you can't deduct more than $10,000. And if you're a property taxpayer in Illinois, that's it. You're done with that. Plus, you probably got more. Income taxes.
There were no
SALT
deductions before.
One of the bills had $10,000 and the other had none. Yeah. So, yes.
But they ended up with a compromise.
Yes, they made a horrendously bad bill slightly less horrendous.
Look, Dave Lundy, you can sit and pull threads out of this tax package all you want. But
no,
you know
I'll pull
what?
The entire fundamental underpinnings
I'm okay standing with workers, small businesses, creating jobs, and kickbacks
for families with children. This won't create jobs. That's what the 295 out of the 300 CEOs said.
Let me say this. 847 has a good point. It said Trump said on the campaign trail, huge cuts, huge tax cuts for the middle class. And, you know, that's the issue here is when it's done, it's not huge tax cuts for the middle class. Yeah. It's not necessarily, as Dave kind of pointed out, the corporate tax is obviously the winner.
Permanent.
Here. Permanent. So. Yeah. Is there going to be an optics problem with the president when there aren't middle class tax cuts huge like the likes of which we've never seen?
In a lot of ways, I never really bought into this marketing genius Donald Trump thing. I never have. And whenever he's in the stump, this just obscene overstating just doesn't help him in the end. Yeah. Case in point, exactly right. What you said.
Is anyone going to hold him to it?
It's the biggest overstatements in the history of mankind. They're huge overstatements.
Yeah. You know, that aside, that doesn't take away from the fact that this is, on average, a good bill, not perfect, that's going to lead to more jobs, that's going to lead to more money in the pockets of people.
Can I just ask you one question?
Yeah, go ahead.
If it's such a good bill, how come the Treasury Department itself that had claimed it had hundreds of economists doing analysis for months and months and months, at the end of the day could produce zero analysis except for this one-pager where it turned out in order to get the 2.9% growth...
The one-pager you're talking about was like 6 months ago.
No, it was last week. What are you talking about?
There was a story
Was a one-pager that they came out with that said you get 2.9% growth, but in order to do that, you don't just have to do the tax cuts, you have to do every other policy Donald Trump is proposing, which of course ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. So, all right, so let's move on from tax cuts. Let's quickly look at the situation with the investigation into Russia and the campaign and collusion. Yesterday, the president's lawyers came out and suggested that the special prosecutor obtained some of the transition emails illegally, and they're therefore tarnished, therefore they should be disqualified, therefore this should be over. Is that a loophole they're trying to exploit? Are they doing the classic lawyer thing where they're trying to get it thrown out before it throws in, or at least dirty the water, or there's something to be said about this?
Donald Trump has bad lawyers. I think that a lot of legal experts have concluded that Donald Trump has very, very bad lawyers. And, you know, there's an old saying in law, I am a recovering lawyer, and there's an old saying, you know, if you can't argue the facts, argue the law. If you can't argue the law, pound the table. And they're pounding the table.
Okay.
So, you know, they're claiming that that the special prosecutor could not get the .gov emails from the transition and that they somehow obtained them illegally. And what Mueller's team said is we either had permission of the holder of the email or we obtained them through legal criminal process. In other words, either a subpoena or some other.
So this doesn't, in your mind, it doesn't stick.
There's zero.
Does this undermine Mueller in any way, Chris?
Well, I can understand why the White House is circling the wagons. You know, no one likes to be investigated, especially by a special counsel. And, you know, there's some real policy problems with the whole notion of a special counsel one. I just think at the end of the day, this is a tempest in a teapot. I mean, honestly, it's gonna blow over.
You want to put money on that?
Yeah, I will put money on that. I will.
A gentleman's bet. But
I'm saying this will not lead to any kind of firing of Robert Mueller. And no one's saying that. Not even Trump. Not even Trump. Not even the Senate Republicans.
So if they're not going to fire Robert Mueller, why is the official organ of the White House, Fox News, having a endless...
Who cares?
It matters because they're trying to influence the public into saying it's okay.
Said, Not even Donald Trump said Mueller should be fired because he knows that would be
Come on. You're a communications professional. You know how this works. He's saying, oh, I would never suggest you fire Rob Mueller. You can't fire Rob Mueller. But in the meantime, every organ I control is going to make the predicate case of why you must fire Robert Mueller.
In Trump speak.
And then at the end, Trump is going to say, I guess I got
to
fire Robert Mueller.
He didn't have to say Robert Mueller shouldn't be fired. He could have said, we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, next week, we'll see.
Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy in studio tonight. Touche. When we come back, let's talk about whether or not 2017 was a win for Democrats or a win for Republicans. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right.
Touche! Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy in studio tonight. This is the final Touche of 2017. That's amazing to think about. We've done so many on Monday nights here on 720 WGN. And it made me think, since it's the last one, well, we could do a wrap-up, we can look ahead to 2018, but ask the question, especially with the verbiage used today with the president and his national security speech about, we're going to win national security, which doesn't seem like the right way to say it, but yeah, I get what he's going for, but we're going to win. So let's use that word, win. And say in 2017, from both of your standpoints, who won? Yeah. Democrats or Republicans?
Yeah. It's a really good question, and it makes me think, quite honestly, of Chicago football. It's just not giving us nothing. And Chicago football is apt here because I think back to the glory days of the Chicago Bears where you had these quarter-long drives, uneventful, just grinding it out. Maybe it would end in something. Maybe it didn't, but it ran out the clock. That's kind of what's happening on a national stage right now. It's sad. It's sad. Politics is broken. When you have one party that's in the White House, Congress, and pretty much controls the courts, can't get anything done but for one tax bill that should happen by the end of the year. And Democrats are just laughable. You know, just disorganized, no agenda, no vision. It's all anti-Trump. That is the one message of the Democratic Party right now. So I say, and I don't want to be the Grinch that stole Christmas here, politics doesn't give me much optimism for 2018.
All right, Dave, you agree?
Well,
with
I'm
that?
Depressed. well, I agree with part of it. Although, actually, I think Chris is not giving the Republicans and the Trump administration enough credit for its malevolence. I think that if you want to say who won politically the year, the Democrats by far.
Oh yeah, of course.
But no, Trump has dropped precipitously in the polls. You have the widest spread of the public wanting the Democrats to control Congress since 2005. Some polls have it at 15. Some polls have it at 11. I mean, it's huge. There is a tsunami building against this president and this party. That said, what Trump has done. In a really malicious sort of way, is he has gutted the federal regulatory scheme by putting people in charge of agencies that don't believe in the agencies that they're in charge of. So you put Scott Pruitt in charge of the EPA, and all Scott Pruitt has done is systematically dismantle the EPA.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's only the air you breathe and the water you drink. I can understand why you don't care.
Alabama, okay, Doug Jones. What's the difference between that and Massachusetts after Obamacare in 2010? There's a little difference.
That's a great question.
It's Groundhog Day.
Actually, that's a great question. Can I answer it?
And so let me finish this point, though.
Okay.
For a country that could go in one election cycle from a Barack Obama to Donald Trump tells you that this country is in pain, is looking for answers, is looking for someone to step into the void. And so they went with the wild card, Donald Trump. But what I'm saying is a pox on both your houses. Republicans and Democrats aren't offering ideas. Let me ask this question. I need to answer his question.
Because he asked, what is the difference between 2010 when Scott Brown was elected and 2017 when Doug Doug Jones is elected. And the difference is that in 2010, Barack Obama said, we're not going to just use our current muscle to shove Obamacare down your throats. We're going to allow your senator, who was just elected, Scott Brown, to take a seat before we vote. Whereas this time, the Republicans said, nah, we're not going to let Doug Jones sit. We're going to shove this down your throat. In every example where the Republicans criticize the Democrats, they are doing 10,000 times worse than they did
before.
The Republicans
have the votes. They're going to get the tax.
Therefore, they just throw all policies and precedent out the window. Well, you're right. That's exactly what they're doing. So thank you for acknowledging this, because this is for you, Chris.
But I am interested in Donald Trump likes to call out that the Democrats didn't have any they liked this tax bill, but they couldn't come out, you know, because of Schumer and Pelosi telling them they want, and they're not involved. They didn't help us at all. And at the same time, you have Republicans who do everything closed door and go to reconciliation, so they don't have to include the party. When we talk about the Democrats and are they win loss on policy? Where do they stand? Because they haven't really, I think you're right in the sense that they're anti-Trump, but they haven't had any policy wins because they haven't been in power.
Yeah, and I think that, look, Chris and a lot of Republicans are criticizing Democrats for not having a message right now, and they're right, they don't. But what the Democrats learned from 2010 and 2014 is that nihilism works, and that if you just say no to the unpopular president with your base, you can sweep the Senate and sweep the House. And so the Democrats learned that, and the White House.
Well, Sue's got a great point.
I don't
she
like
says,
it. But
a win for Republicans, a win for Democrats. When does someone care if it's a win for us
in the United States? Great point, Sue. Thanks.
And, you know, that's
I would argue the Democrats care precisely that it's a win for the people, which is why they're fighting against these awful, awful policies like stripping people's health care, like stripping putting the tax breaks all in the hands of the wealthy. I mean, it's the Democrats who are standing up for the American people and the Republicans who are saying, no, we're going to give our corporate donors all the benefits.
Yeah, elections have consequences, too. I mean, the people sure embraced all that Democratic caring. You know,
so and your point.
This was your year too, 2016. This was your year. I'm talking about like the Senate. You should have at least got the Senate.
And your point is absolutely legitimate. But you're not being shy about the fact we've got the power. So suck it.
Yeah, pretty much.
I wish that was it for Touche. That's like the best end line for 2017 to be like. And as Dave Lundy says, happy holidays and suck it. But I will say that as we still have a couple minutes, so
because there's more,
it was a great end line that we have to still do two or three more minutes here. But as I look ahead, I mean, the 2018 election season, both at the state level and the midterms coming up. I mean, there's a lot that can go in different directions in this country.
Yeah.
Are the people right now fed up with what's happened in 2017?
Yeah. It's not unusual for the sitting president to take a hit, especially in these off year elections. But that's just the way it's always been. So in that respect, Alabama kind of isn't unusual, although there was like a horrific candidate.
Oh, it was pretty unusual.
Horrific candidate.
Yeah, that's an anomaly.
Put aside the child groping thing. He was just a bad candidate.
Yes, he was crazy.
Too. But Dave, there is a wave building, and I think Republicans should be concerned about those butterfly wing flaps. It could turn into something pretty serious next November. Donald Trump billed himself as a deal maker. That was his number one attribute. If he's smart, he'll find a way to work with Democrats.
Last thought, Dave.
Republicans are going to take advantage of the growing deficits put in place by their tax plan to try to gut entitlements. Paul Ryan's already said he's going to do it.
Say nothing of Obamacare.
Well, they're not going to be able to gut Obamacare, but they are going to try to gut entitlements, and the combination of that benefits for their
no chance.
But their attempts
never,
to do it
never
combined with the benefits that the tax plans put in the hands of their wealthy donors is going to help to make sure that 2018 is a great year for Democrats.
There you go, Dave Lundy, Chris Veronis. Happy New Year, guys. We'll see you coming up.
Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah.
This time it's complete to Cunningham, and Benny Cunningham is in the end zone for the Bears' first touchdown. Down. Got through the would-be Darius Slay tackle, and Cunningham has his second receiving touchdown of the season.
That's really good out of the backfield. Get the ball to them in space. They missed it the play before. get it to him. He does a nice job. A little out under move, getting into the end zone. But really a good drive there. I know little too late, but a nice drive. And we keep talking about it. They've got to learn how to do some of these things.
You weren't kidding, Pete. That's the highlight of Saturday's Bears game against the Lions, a loss 20-10. But there really isn't any plays to pull out. The Bears, they performed uninspired in losing effort, both on the offense and defense side of the ball. They did nothing. Late in the game, Mitchell Trubisky in garbage time threw the ball and maybe set records for himself and got the coach, John Fox, to say, arguably his best performance to date. I didn't see it. I don't think any Chicago Bears fan saw it. What we saw was a 4-9 team that was about to be 4-10. Adam Hoge joins us as he does every Monday for the Monday Evening Quarterback. Adam, of course, covers the Bears for WGN Radio. You can find out all his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Adam, good to talk with you, buddy.
Hey, Justin.
A lot of energy there, bud.
Here we go. I mean, it's just another one of these games that right when you think they turn the corner, then they deliver another stinker.
I mean, this really was if you're really going to break apart or really break down a stinker, this was it. The Chicago Bears looked lifeless in the first half, and really not till the end of the game, even at the end of the game, weren't in this thing.
Yeah. And for the record, I had this as Trubisky's fourth best game. I keep track of this stuff throughout just from the way I graded out. This came out to his fourth best game. So I didn't agree with John Fox. I thought John Fox, if we're going to really get into this, kind of sounded like a coach who was trying to make the case that he can actually develop Trubisky. Mm. Sitting there in that press conference today, that's kind of how I read a bunch of his answers. It seemed like he was, look, John Fox is many things. Head coach of the Chicago Bears in 2018 is probably not one of them, but he's smart. I mean, he's been around this league long enough to know that this whole job decision over who's going to be head coach of the Bears going forward is really based mostly on the quarterback, right?
Right. And
who can get the most out of the guy that Ryan Pace has bet his job on, and that's Mitch Trubisky. So I thought that John Fox was really trying to make the case today that there's a lot of good things that they've gotten out of Mitch Trubisky, and that's true, actually. But I still don't. I think when you look at his offense, you realize that this is not a great situation for him to be developing in. So I think Fox probably oversold Mitch's performance Saturday in Detroit.
The Lions do not have a great defense. They had a good corner play, and they've got a pass rush in there. But they can be beat. They will have games where people put a lot of points and a lot of numbers up. Mitchell Trubisky, you're right, looked like a step back in the way that the Bears' offense looked dominant. In the first half, I mean, if it wasn't for a fluke fumble, they're shut out. And more often than not, Adam, that's what we're seeing is a Mitchell Trubisky who will make a nice 3rd and 12 play, and you're like, wow, nice throw. He could throw the ball. But when it comes to actually developing, meaning getting the ball, punching it in the end zone, taking the lead, responding when the other team scores a touchdown, that stuff is far from being figured out with Mitchell Trubisky.
Yeah, what I did like, though, Justin, is after the first interception, he came back and made a really nice throw on the next drive. And he hung in there. Look, there was, I had 13 throws that I thought were really good. Two that were excellent, like elite level type stuff. I mean, when he's backed up at his own 1 yard line,
right.
And I think it was 1st and 17 after a penalty or a negative play, one or the other. There were so many in this game, and he stands back there. He's got the pressure coming in his face. He's standing in his own end zone, and he delivered a strike downfield. That is really, really impressive. But let's put the interceptions aside for a second. There were too many other throws that were inaccurate in this game. And I docked him for all of that. You know, just even short throws that were a little high. Let's go to the one touchdown in this game. Benny Cunningham, right? He threw that. They ran that play two plays in a row.
Yeah, right.
The first one, it was open, and Mitch's throw was high. So they went back to it, threw a nice throw, and he got it. So a lot of good, a lot of bad. He looked like a rookie. He looked like a promising rookie to me in this game.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've said that a lot on this show this season, and because that's what he is. He's a guy in a tough situation that I still think is showing a lot of promise. but is work having to work out a lot of things on the fly here, and I think that's okay.
Yeah, and I just wonder, Adam, and since we're talking about the offensive side of the ball for a while here, again, the running game is non-existent, like not even NFL level, and the Bears are so Jekyll and Hyde with this all season long, where you'll have announcers that will bend over backwards to compliment the Chicago Bears running game. We talk with Jim Caldwell, and he's, oh, they're so afraid of the Bears running game, and then you see this where, would Jordan Howard even get 20 yards? I mean, at a certain point, every time they handed the ball off, it was a negative play or a one-yarder. I mean, it just seemed to me a very uninspired performance by not just the Bears, not just the quarterback, but the running backs, the offensive line. They across the board had to get failing grades.
But part of it is also the run designs. And this, you know, this is something I tweeted earlier as I was watching the film today. The Bears are too predictable, okay? And it's teams watch film, all right? And there was also, look, I can go into the passing game too. There was one play where Mitch Trubisky looked like a high throw on third down, but really what it was the corner jammed Kendall Wright because they watched the film. They realized that he's the guy they're going to on a slant on third down. Mm-hmm. And it looked like it was a throw that was 4 yards short of the first down marker, and it was. But in the past, that has worked. That slant has turned into a first down to Kendall Wright, but they're watching the film. Same thing in the running game. Dow Loggins consistently this season has brought his wide receivers from actually being wide receivers and brought them in closer to the offensive line, right? How many of these like bunch formations have we seen where they just hand the ball off? Well, what happens when you bring those wide receivers in, you're essentially bringing extra defenders into the box. They're already loading the box, but now you're bringing cornerbacks and safeties out from the outside where they'd have to cover a wide receiver one-on-one into the box. So that's adding more defenders to stop the run. And as they watch the film and realize, hey, this is what they're doing, I saw it at least three times on film in this game Saturday where those DBs, those defensive backs, were cheating. They were, at the snap, immediately jumping in to stop the run and not even worrying about the wide receiver that they were technically on. That's killing them. And it also led to, like, Josh Bellamy's block in the back penalty came on that exact thing, because you're asking your wide receivers to block defensive backs who are quick and already getting a jump into the inside. There's no possible way to actually execute that block unless you push them from behind, which is what Josh Bellamy did on one of those plays, and he got flagged for it. But I put that on the offensive coordinator for the play design, not necessarily the player for getting caught for the penalty.
And we're seeing more often, even the announcers in that game, it was interesting, on the interception where Trubisky threw high and the interception on the sideline, they called it out that's the bread and butter play. That's the play that they roll him out left and he's got two options. And it, as you just mentioned, it seems more often than not that that's a pretty predictable play. The defenses are understanding what Loggins is trying to do and therefore what Mitchell Trubisky is trying to do.
Yeah. Are you talking about the interception?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He threw it high. I understand that. But the point I was making is they called it out in the broadcast that is a predictable play for the Bears offense.
And it's also he has struggled throwing, rolling to his left and throwing from that. So, he said that's a throw that he'll make 10 out of 10 times next time. Yeah. And I get that. That's the one thing about this game that I'm actually okay with. Mitch had a great quote today, I thought, where he said that he tries to focus more on the process rather than the results. And we were talking about this a little bit in the media room at House Hall today, just me and some of the beat reporters, because some other guys kind of took exception to that, saying, you know, at the end of the game, end of the day, you are judged by your wins and losses. Yeah. You have to care about the results, and I get that. But look, in this position they're in right now, they're 4-10. It really should be about Mitch getting better. So they get put in a tough position here in this game. It wasn't Mitch's fault that they were behind, but he got put in a position where they had to throw a lot. And you're going to make mistakes when you have to throw a lot. But he also made a lot of good throws. So I actually understood where John Fox and Mitch Trubisky were coming from today when they were able to point out some of the positives from this game.
Okay, let me counter that.
Okay.
As a Bears fan and people watching, once again, we complained about this on this very same segment. When the Bears lost to the Green Bay Packers, and this was week 3 or week 4, where the Bears got blown out, and that was the end of Mike Glennon. There was a play when we were down maybe 34-13 or whatever it was, where the Bears went to running the ball and slow, like they did a 9, 10, 11 play drive to march down the field in the fourth quarter, where
yep.
you actually were like, why are you taking this much time? Flash forward to the Detroit Lions game, where the Bears are down 20-3 and it's pretty much over, and they pull off a 13-play, 92-yard drive with a couple of third downs and fourth downs, and they had 7-8 minutes to get there. No sense of urgency whatsoever. And I felt like it kind of bit them in the butt because they got the ball back at 20-10, but they had no more time left. And it just, to me, is like, I don't feel the urgency. I don't feel like this team is like, we're going to claw and scratch, and we've got the heart and soul, and you'll never be able to beat us, not until the buzzer goes. That's not this Chicago Bears team.
Well, part of the problem on that specific drive you're talking about is that the Bears had 5 penalties.
Ugh.
So it's kind of hard to march down the field in 5 plays in, you know, under 2 minutes. When you keep killing yourselves with those kinds of penalties. And I'll get back to the fact that Mitch made 3 or 4 incredible throws on that drive just to keep it going when they were behind the chains. But I get your point. Yeah, I understand. I will say the one thing that was frustrating about that specific drive you bring up in Green Bay when it was Mike Glennon, it was kind of like they had just given up.
Yeah, right.
They had kind of given up.
I got
up
the same vibe, man, on Saturday. I got the same vibe that this was Fox going, well, we're not going to win this game. Maybe well, that doesn't show with like you're talking about with the penalties and everything there. But as a fan, watching a team grind out a 13-play drive when they're down 17 points, you want to shut the game off.
I understand that frustration. Well, in the entire time, this was just an ugly game. It wasn't a pretty game at all. I thought it would be way more competitive. After what we saw, I didn't think the Bears were going to win, but I thought after what we saw in Cincinnati that they would come out a lot faster than they did. And unfortunately, that's been a theme this season. You know, just coming out of the bye with that performance against the Packers, against right. Brett Hundley. That's a game you should have won, and they just came out completely flat.
Adam Hogue, WGN Radio. You can find his stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Monday evening quarterback, 312-981-7200. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can text, you can call. What's your thoughts on this 4-10 team? What was your takeaway from the humiliating loss to the Lions on national TV? It's the only national TV we were getting, and we blew it. Adam Hogue with us. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us.
2nd and 8. Here's Trubisky. Ansa pursuing, but he got rid of it. And interception. What a job by Slay. Big play, Darius Slay. Both feet down. Looked like a wide receiver. Interception. And the Lions will take over.
All right. It's a Monday evening quarterback here. 312-981-7200. We're breaking down the Bears' loss to the Detroit Lions on national television on Saturday. Adam Hogue joins us as he does every Monday for the Monday evening quarterback. This, of course, gives us a little bit more nuance to what we saw on the football field. You can find all of Adam's stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. All right, so some of the texts coming in are about John Fox and the thought and some of the things you talked about right at the beginning about him almost auditioning to be the guy who develops Mitchell Trubisky next year.
Yeah.
And most of the texts are coming in say, you know, Fox is this, Fox is that. But he doesn't really have a track record for this. And that's the problem I have as a fan, knowing, you know, with the Carolina Panthers, it was a great defense and Jake Delhomme. And with the Broncos, it was a great defense and Tim Tebow. And we'll take Peyton Manning out of the mix because he essentially was the coach. This is not his forte. He's not a guy who develops quarterbacks or seems to even care about quarterbacks.
Right. I mean, the most success he's had was when Peyton Manning was his quarterback. Or when Jake Delhomme, you know, Jake Delhomme is really an outlier. But he wasn't a guy that was really developed, right? So the one guy that you point to that the Carolina Panthers drafted was Jimmy Clausen out of Notre Dame, and he didn't do anything. He turned out to be a bust. Eventually took Jay Cutler's job.
I guess he took
Chicago for
I
one
guess
week.
Who he didn't draft Tim Tebow? Did he? He just came in to deal with him.
Yeah, I believe he inherited him. I think Tebow it may have been Tebow.
The guy Josh McDaniels got?
Oh, yeah, that was Josh McDaniels who drafted him. Yeah, yeah. So he inherited Tim, and I don't think that John Fox is very fond of Tim Tebow. Some of the stories I've heard the last few years, that was just a thing kind of out of necessity. And,
yeah, they were out of quarterbacks.
And maybe you give him some credit for making the playoffs with Tim Tebow, actually winning a playoff game with Tim Tebow. But this your original point is correct. He does not have a track record of developing quarterbacks at all. The one opportunity he had was Jimmy Clausen, and stunningly at the NFL Combine this year, John Fox admitted that he never even watched Jimmy Clausen's tape before they drafted him.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I don't think he wanted Jimmy Clausen.
All right. Let's keep going in that area when talking about coaching staff. Let's go to Jesse. Jesse, you're on the Monday Evening Quarterback. What's your question for Adam?
Yeah, hey, guys. I wanted to hear what your thoughts were on Greg Gabriel's slew of tweets. I don't know if you saw him, but he was talking about how Dow Loggins was kind of talking himself up. He almost like reported to some friends and to some sources possibly that he was kind of touting himself as the next Bears head coach.
Hmm.
And this is coming from the guy who was obviously, you know, an NFL scout for 30 years. And I'm pretty sure he was like leading the Bears scouting department for like 10 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Hmm. What do you think about that idea, Adam, to Dow Loggins head coach rumors?
Yeah, so I have the exact tweet from Greg Gable in front of me, actually. And Greg was the Bears director of college scouting in the Jerry Angelo era. And he tweeted during the game on Saturday. I saw this at the time. He said, was told weeks ago that Loggins believed and was telling people that he was going to be the Bears head coach in 2018. What a dreamer. Couldn't be the head coach of a high school JV team. So Greg,
I know that about Greg Gabriel, bringing the sass.
Yeah, I've gotten to know Greg a little bit the last few years now that he's a member of the media, and I think he does a great job with the NFL draft, and he can get kind of testy during games on Twitter, which I enjoy. I enjoy from Greg. Look, I don't know. I'm sure that he was told this, and it's, you know, there's probably some credibility to the fact that maybe Loggins. Well, I'm going to trust Greg on this. Greg has a lot of great sources and knows a lot of people in the league. So at some point, Loggins probably did believe that if John Fox
wanted the job, right, whatever.
Right,
yeah.
And you know what? He probably said that to somebody who thought he was just as crazy as probably everyone else does, just seeing this tweet from Greg Gabriel, and that's probably why it got around. So, I'm not going to fault Dow Loggins for having confidence in himself and believing that someday he'll be a head coach. I think we can all agree, though, he's not going to be the head coach of the Bears in 2018.
I mean, you can understand where we're heading in this idea that you would think that the next coach of the Chicago Bears, if it's not going to be Foxy, if he's not going to stick around, is going to be offensive-minded in the way that you're looking for someone who has a history or a chemistry with Mitchell Trubisky?
Yeah, so there's a couple interesting ways to look at this. I mean, the plus side of bringing in an offensive head coach is that you at least know that that guy's always going to be there if you guys have success, right? Mm-hmm. The problem with not having an offensive head coach is if he brings in a great coordinator that does a great job with Mitch Trubisky, that guy's going to get hired as a head coach elsewhere, right? Just look at the 1 year of Adam Gase.
Right.
And he had some great results with Jay Cutler, immediately got hired away.
So just get an offense, get a head coach who calls the plays.
Well, not necessarily, but just somebody that, you know, if the coordinator does get hired away, you can always depend on the head coach to still be, you know, linked together.
Isn't that kind of the situation in Philadelphia, right, with Doug Peterson? Like, he's the guy who's the everyone loves there. He's the OC, or he's the head coach. He's also got an offensive mind, right?
And everyone else can leave.
It won't matter. They still have him and Carson Wentz, right?
Right. Mike McCarthy with Aaron Rodgers, and of course, you know, Bill Belichick with Tom Brady. I mean, these are now Sean McVay with Jared Goff. I mean, these are, I think we've seen a pattern over the last 20 years in the NFL of the winning franchises having a great quarterback, but not only a great quarterback, one that is linked together with the head coach. But I also, and I've been saying this for weeks now, just we know better now in Chicago because Phil Emery tried this. He tried to bring in Mark Trestman and be. He tried this formula. The one thing that Phil Emery saw correctly was that he had to develop this. Unfortunately, right. He just hired the wrong head coach and he had the wrong quarterback. So
well, we see that as fans, right? I would, as a longtime Chicago Bears fan, I would see that as an anomaly, a bad choice to get a guy from the Canadian Football League. I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I would go after another offensive coordinator to link with a young quarterback because think about it. You had Trestman, who was writing books on philosophy, and Jay Cutler. I don't know how they thought that was going to work, where they would link together. It didn't. But I think that a young Mitchell Trubisky and a young offensive coordinator who becomes head coach, I think there could be something there. Although I love the defense, but yeah.
Right. Well, what I was getting at really is that the guy has to be able to be a head coach too.
Right, right.
That's what all these other guys that I've mentioned have proven that they can do. You have to be able to manage a locker room. You have to be able to manage a whole team. You can hire a great coordinator and say, all right, you go coach the defense. I'm going to worry about the offense. But you still have to be the CEO of the locker room. Mark Trestman couldn't do that at the NFL level. He somehow managed to do that at the Canadian Football League. Good for him. But it was an absolute disaster with the personalities they had in the locker room at Hallis Hall for those 2 years. It just completely fell apart. So go get an offensive guy. Great. But he also has to be able to be a head coach, first and foremost.
Well, hey, I got a great idea. Ron Rivera. Let's bring him back, defensive coordinator, head coach, whatever it is. Bring him back because all the weird stuff that's going on in Carolina. Boom. Everybody's happy. The 85 Bears crew is happy. Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
And bring Cam Newton, too. Do a trade for Trubisky and Cam Newton.
I wouldn't completely rule out that Ron Rivera might end up being available out of all this.
I know he's a defensive coordinator first, but there's just something there where you're like, yeah, let's get one of these guys. All right, here's what we'll do. Let's take a quick break so we can get the news with Rob. We'll come back to Monday Evening Quarterback. I got a lot of texts to get to as well. 312-981-7200 if you'd like to call in or text. Talk to Adam Hoge about the Bears and what we do with the last two games of the season. All right, stay with us.
Really down three starters if you think of Kyle Long not being in the mix at the moment right now because he's on IR. Trubisky fires sideline. What a throw in time. Kendall Wright, yeah, right around the 40-yard line. Good throw and catch.
Come on, man. I love it, Pete. We're getting third and eights. That's where we're at on the highlights from Saturday's loss. The Bears lose to the Lions, go to 4-10. Maybe because the San Francisco 49ers have found their quarterback in Jimmy Garoppolo, maybe that means that they'll hopscotch the Bears and we'll get better draft picks. Oh, joy. Oh, joy. Adam Hoge, of course, covers the Bears here at WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com/Bears. You can find all his great stuff. Joins us for the Monday Evening Quarterback, 312-981-7200. We were having fun before about this become a pastime for Bears fans to think about who the next coach is going to be. It's not a good thing to kind of wonder about. But I kind of enjoy the idea of thinking about the offensive coordinators that are coming up, or maybe some of these sidelines. You always hear John Gruden's name thrown around when it comes to new coaching. What do we hear about the coaching carousel and whether or not there are names that Chicago Bears fans should be looking at?
Well, I'll give you one name that just intrigues me. I haven't heard anything about this, but it is somebody to watch who is currently a head coach in the league. And we just had a discussion in the last segment about Ron Rivera because it's just an interesting situation out there in Carolina with the ownership change. And they look like they're going to make the playoffs, but what if they bottom out here in the next couple weeks? Could be interesting. But another name is Bill O'Brien in Houston. Bill O'Brien has been there for, I think, 5 years now.
Yeah.
Made the playoffs a few times, really based on their defense and a weak AFC South division, if we're being honest.
Right.
But he is an offensive guy who is kind of known for, you know, he was in New England before he took the Penn State job. And he did a great job at Penn State, considering the circumstances he inherited after the Paterno-Sandusky scandal. It was pretty amazing what he did there just to keep that program afloat, which is why he got the NFL job he did. But in Houston, they have struggled to find him a quarterback. Now, I think he deserves some of that blame because he's part of the evaluation that goes into these quarterbacks. But time after time after time, whether it's Brock Osweiler,
yeah,
or these other Tom Savage, some of these other guys that have been going through there, it's been ugly. And that's been their problem. And now they're 4-10, tied with the Bears for a record. And I wouldn't be surprised if they make a head coaching change at the end of the year. But I'll tell you what. When Deshaun Watson was playing earlier this season,
they looked good.
Bill O'Brien looked like a pretty good head coach,
yeah.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
And I still think he is a good head coach. If you look at how they've maintained a good defense, that's an encouraging sign.
With
you
a lot, want, of, like, lot of injuries, yeah.
I think his players play hard for him. I think they respect him. So in that conversation we just had in the last segment about, yes, you want an offensive guy. You want somebody that can be married to Mitch Trubisky. You also need somebody that can actually manage a locker room and keep the defense going. And I like Bill O'Brien as a coach. That's just somebody to keep an eye on if he doesn't keep his job in Houston.
He'd be much more interesting at Halas Hall for press conferences and stuff. He's got an interesting personality. I'm not sure, because I remember watching this season of Hard Knocks. They did the Houston Texans. That could be interesting. Let's go to Pat. Pat, you're on the Monday Evening Quarterback. What's your question for Adam?
Yeah, I was thinking about the offensive coordinator for Detroit, Jim Bob Cooter. Mm-hmm. Who has to know the division the Bears are in? You could get 6 wins right there and pull off 4 other wins. You get a 10-win season right off the bat.
Yeah, what about Jim Bob Cooter, the weirdest name in NFL?
Yeah, I know we'd have a lot of fun with it here in Chicago. It's an interesting name. I think you would kind of make the comparisons to Sean McVay because of the age. Jim Bob Cooter is only 33 years old, so he'd be very, very young. Not quite as young as Sean McVay, who I believe just turned 32, but he was hired when he was 31. And he's getting a lot of credit for the job he's done with Matthew Stafford, who for many years, Stafford's always been in that category of guys you love in terms of the potential and the talent, but he also had plenty of mistakes. There were comparisons to Jay Cutler a lot. And really, in the last couple seasons, there's just no denying Stafford's a good quarterback now. And Cooter's getting a lot of that credit. So I would just go back to, okay, he's young. Can he manage the locker room? You're kind of taking a chance there, promoting him all the way to head coach. But I can understand why people are talking about him.
Yeah, there's a lot of great names. The LA Rams came up, and we kind of talked about this last week, Adam, that the idea, the 773 kind of ingests as, can we get the Rams to come to Chicago? We need a second team. But but there's something to be said that, you know, everybody's got their eyes on the LA Rams or maybe the Philadelphia Eagles because of the last year having terrible years and being able to, you know, flip a switch and with a new coach or with new blood, whatever it is, the same personnel essentially be able to turn into a playoff team and a dominant dominant regular season team right now, where the Rams are just, I mean, the Rams and the Eagles are just beating people.
Yeah, it's a copycat league, and everyone wants to figure out these Sean McVay, Jared Goff, Doug Peterson, Carson Wentz type situations, and I'm sure that's what Ryan Pace is thinking a lot about right now. And this is all, of course, assuming that Ryan Pace is coming back, which I believe he is. Mm. Now, let me give you one scenario. This is really the only scenario I can imagine. I think it's far-fetched for this franchise right now. But it is a scenario. One national NFL writer that I recommend reading on a weekly basis is Ben Volen, who writes for the Boston Globe. And every Sunday he has an NFL notes column that's always interesting and full of good nuggets. And one of the things they're watching in New England right now is Josh McDaniels, Josh McDaniels is another name that he could have had a head coaching job last year, but he decided to stay in New England. Now, what I didn't know until reading Ben Volen's notes this week was that he was interviewing in conjunction with Nick Caserio. Nick Caserio is basically Bill Belichick's right-hand man.
Is that the guy with the big beard on the sideline?
Patricia, their defensive coordinator.
Okay. Yeah. The guy that just looks like a bigger version of Belichick.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Caserio is basically the Patriots GM, except Belichick's the GM too, you know what I mean? So he's in the front office. So basically, they were interviewing last year as a package deal. Hmm. GM, head coach. And they apparently, according to the story I read in the Boston Globe, were offered the 49ers job together. So Caserio would have been the GM, and Josh McDaniels would have been the head coach. But this is crazy. Part of the reason why they didn't take that job is they didn't like the quarterback situation, and they didn't think that they could get Jimmy Garoppolo away from Bill Belichick. These are the guys that are working with Belichick. So, you know, these reports that have been out there that Belichick was just not going to trade Garoppolo last offseason, if his own right-hand man and offensive coordinator did not think that they could take Garoppolo with them to San Francisco or get him at all, and they were willing to turn down promotions for that in a brand new job, that tells you a lot.
Yeah, it does.
But if those two are interviewing together and there have to be a package deal or it's not going to happen and the Bears really want to pull off something like that, that's pretty much the only scenario where I could see Ryan Pace getting kicked out the door. I think that's very far-fetched. I think Pace will probably stay, and the Josh McDaniels thing is just not going to happen.
I mean, what are we talking about? This would be year four or year three for Pace coming up here? So he would be in the point that there's a lot of evaluation coming up on the results that he has put on the field.
Yeah, I mean, there's 2 years left on his contract. He signed a five-year deal. John Fox only signed a four-year deal, which was interesting and something that we reported at the time. So that's partly why it's easier to get rid of Fox right now, because you only have to pay out 1 year, whereas Pace is still on the hook for two.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wrote about this last week, Justin. Don't know if you saw it, but my big piece in the middle of last week was the case for Ryan Pace.
Yeah, right.
And it wasn't really like I was shelling for him, like, hey, you got to bring this guy back. It was more so, hey, look, here's literally everything he's done in 3 years. Here's the whole ledger. You can read it for yourself and figure it out. But my own conclusion after I laid it all out was there's more good than bad, and there's reason to believe this team can turn the corner next year. And I think he deserves at least one more talent acquisition cycle in this offseason.
312-981-7200 is a phone number. 630 says, bring back Dave Taub. His name gets thrown around, I think, because we love Devin Hester so much.
But you know what? That's another name I was going to bring up.
Do you see a lot of jumps from special team coordinators to head coach?
No, and in fact, John Harbaugh is the one that everyone talks about, but John Harbaugh had to become a defensive coordinator before he actually got promoted to head coach. So it just doesn't happen, but I don't understand why it doesn't happen more. What people don't realize is special teams coordinators, first of all, they work with both the offense and the defensive players.
Right.
But because of their duties being so specialized into special teams, that's why it's called that, they often are given extra head coaching responsibilities, sort of as an assistant head coach, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. For instance, here in Chicago, Jeff Rogers, the Bears special teams coordinator, handles a lot of the day-to-day stuff, like practice schedules and just making sure everything gets run correct. And that's relatively common throughout the league. So in terms of just knowing what goes into being a head coach on a day-to-day basis, which I think doesn't get talked about enough, when coaches just sort of fail and they never make that transition from being a good coordinator to a good head coach, it's partly because all that time they spend grinding and watching film and coming up with schemes, they don't realize how much of time consumption it takes to just be a head coach, to manage an entire team. So that's why I like the idea of special teams coordinators becoming head coaches, because I think that they, in that regard, they actually have more experience than some of these hotshot young coordinators that end up getting hired.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it doesn't happen more often. And the other thing in Dave Taub's case that I like, he knows his Bears organization inside and out. And I think that's something that can work in his favor.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely like, I think fans do like when there's connection to the coach. That's when Ron Rivera comes up and you're like, oh yeah, 85 Bear. Or Taub, where you're like, oh yeah, Devin Hester. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, I would think, is there any chance that the Bears, remember, it was maybe in the 90s, they kind of botched this a little bit, where there was thought that perhaps a Mike Singletary or a former Bear was coming up the ranks, or maybe he'd be a good coordinator and didn't work out. Like, I forgot Jerron was going to hire him or something like that. Is there any chance that are any former glory Bears in coaching? You know, Leslie Frazier is still a coaching, right? I mean, but any connection to the old stat or the old team that would be worth considering?
I think we talked about the two guys that really would be.
Taub and Rivera, huh?
Yeah, I think Ron Rivera, if he became available, would I'm sure the McCaskey family would want him. I don't know what kind of connections he has to Ryan Pace, and it's still going to be Pace's call.
Yeah.
Same thing with Taub. I mean, Taub has strong connections with Chris Ballard, the GM in Indianapolis, so I would think he gets a hard look there because the Colts are probably changed. That's the other thing about this, Justin. You look right now across the league, how many teams might be changing head coaches?
Right.
You know, usually seven's kind of the magic number every year, somewhere around seven teams. I think it's going to be at least double digits, and it might be up to like 12. It's going to be a crazy head coaching year, and those are all – that's kind of why – that's something I talked about a few weeks ago when I talked about letting Fox go in the middle of the year. you could jump out in front of this thing and start lining your ducks up, and you can't quite start interviews yet with NFL coaches, but you can start getting your ducks in a row. And so that's just something to keep in mind. One other name, I don't know if it's too soon for this, but I don't know if you saw in New York, but Josh McCown's hurt now.
Mm-hmm.
Josh McCown, I know just from interviewing and getting to know him here when he was the quarterback, would be a great coach.
Oh, he's,
I don't know
if he goes to do it.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what he wants to do, but they're already making him a player coach type situation. This past weekend, he did that. I don't know if he can jump to being a head coach right now, but maybe that's somebody you think about as an offensive coordinator.
Or a quarterback's coach or something like that.
Absolutely.
Adam Hogue on the line, 312-981-7200. We're getting some good texts in. Bring back Shoop. That's always a good one. Vince Tobin. 815's got a great one. Couldn't agree more with you guys when it comes to the Bears. No sense of urgency, no fire under anyone's butt. Maybe an occasional defensive lineman play that fires them up. Poor clock management, and for goodness sake, let Mitchell Trubisky throw it down the field. Here's my question to that. Those defensive linemen, tomorrow the Pro Bowl selections come out. Are the Bears going to be shut out again, or does Akeem Hicks have a chance to play for the team? And last year, I guess they didn't get shut out because 17 guys got hurt, and they're like, give it to Jordan Howard or whatever it was.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure. Here's the interesting thing. If you were to ask me who should be the Pro Bowler, if you had to pick one guy in the entire team, and it could only be one, it would definitely be Akeem Hicks. And by the way, Akeem Hicks played great on Saturday. I just got done grading the film. He was outstanding. And he had a sack, and there was one play. I'm hoping to get the gif of it up on Twitter later at Adam Hogue on Twitter, where he just bull rushed a guy straight backwards into and it tripped the running back. So he essentially made the tackle just by running over his own guy and pushing him into the running back. Those types of plays are great. So I think Hicks should be. I'm skeptical he will be, though, because he doesn't really have the sack numbers. But what people forget, he's not going to win the fan vote. I'm not sure he wins the player vote. I hope there's enough coaches out there, because it's a three-part deal and how these guys make the Pro Bowl. I hope enough coaches out there are appreciating what Akeem Hicks is doing this year. Because if you turn on the film and you go through it, he has been dominant in almost every game, maybe one or two where he's had kind of a quiet game, but he's been great. I just think Howard probably gets more. They just look at the stats and go, oh, he's up at the top of the league in rushing. And he has. So I think it's more likely that Howard gets in than Hicks, but it really should be Hicks.
Yeah, I agree. It seems like the only player. I think Danny Trevathan's had a great year. He's been hurt, and he had the suspension as well. And I'm not advocating that he be in the Pro Bowl. But he, when you talk about who the gamers, you know, we talked that great text that came in about no heart, you know, from 815. Who are the gamers on the squad? That I'm not talking about their best running in practice or you know, what their value is, but they show up around the ball. And Akeem Hicks, Danny Trevathan, Leonard Floyd, and Pernell McPhee also play that way. Lamar, and I got to give a little credit to Lamar Houston.
Oh, yeah.
As a guy that came off the waiver wire, he has a knack. What, two more sacks in that game yesterday? I mean, again, it's all slop. It's all garbage time at this point. But it is interesting to see that Lamar Houston has got, I mean, he's getting his number called a lot.
But he's playing for his NFL life right now, and he's looking like a guy who shouldn't have been cut in the first place this year.
Yeah, right. Again, and you know, Adam, we were on talking about this. He had, and I remember he got hurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
He got hurt at the end of preseason, but in that game in which he was on the bubble, I think it was against Cleveland.
Yeah.
He was a monster.
He was
and he got
great.
Hurt in that game, and it was like, and they cut him for injury or whatever, but there was a great, I mean, he was a guy that we were thinking big things from.
What's interesting is that the Texans cut him, too. Like, I sort of understand why the Bears cut him. He had been hurt so many times, and here you go again. Could you really depend on him a few weeks? Because they would have had to carry him on the 53 roster for a few weeks while he recovered, because he was out the first few weeks. Then he signs with Houston. They ended up cutting him. So, I mean, of course, they have a lot more depth on their talent on their defense than the Bears do. But, I think here's another interesting name. It's too bad he got hurt early in the year. But I think that Sherrick McManus was actually on pace for a Pro Bowl as a special teamer. Mm-hmm. He was close last year. He was a Pro Bowl alternate. A lot of people don't realize that. and he didn't get in there. But that was a goal of his this year, and he was playing outstanding early in the season before he got hurt, and has been good the last couple weeks again. But I just think that those games he missed are probably going to be the difference. Yeah. Between he was out for,
you know, the other name that is so intriguing to me, because we've seen flashes, and I would say that Eddie Jackson, the safety for the Chicago Bears, has what, two of the three best plays of the entire season, all in one game against Baltimore or whatever it was.
Yeah,
or one of the Carolina, whatever one that they won.
This is the
Carolina game, yeah. Where he returned a fumble and an interception for a touchdown. He, for all of that, what he does, and you're like, oh, great, finally, some life. He is maddening and frustrating as a cover guy. The game changed, and the Bears lost that game when they let Matthew Stafford roll out, and he threw a bomb in the, I think it was the second quarter, yeah. And Eddie Jackson had position for an interception. And once again, and I don't know where, if it's in the water at Halas Hall, but they're almost afraid to pick the ball off. He let the guy stand in front of him on a busted play, and it was a 50-yard. It put the Lions in scoring position to essentially put the game away so early. And I don't know what's up. I thought he was brought in to be a guy who was around the ball, a ball hawk, who could understand. And this is the second time I've seen him do that, because there was, I forgot what game it was, and we complained about it here, where there was a deep ball, and it looked like he had a pick, and he let the receiver get it. I forgot what it was. I think it was Green Bay, maybe. But yeah. The point being, it was like, what is up with that? That is so infuriating as a Bears fan.
I mean, there's so many things infuriating about that whole situation there. Okay, it starts with John Fox punting on 4th and 1 at
yes,
his own 45.
Yes.
When first and foremost, we throw out all the other situations where he's done that. We know that's his MO. Fine. But in this situation, your defense had been on the field pretty much the entire game at that point. You needed to extend that drive just to keep them off the field, and he punts, puts them back out there. They were tired. Why did Matthew Stafford get out in the first place on that play you're talking about? Because the guys were tired. They actually got a decent rush, but they couldn't. Akeem Hicks just couldn't quite get to him. Flushed him out to the side. As soon as that happened, that's when crazy things happened. And he's able to get out because the defense was tired. Throws the ball up. It's just a jump ball at that point. If it gets intercepted, he doesn't care. It's like a punt.
Yeah.
Okay. Eddie Jackson, you're absolutely right. So after all those things happened, and I think they have to be pointed out, you get to the actual play, and Eddie Jackson, I think he thought it was just his ball and that there was no one else there. I don't know how else to explain it, because you're right. He didn't seem to realize that Marvin Jones was right there to undercut him and make the play, because he was just trying to catch the ball. Yeah. And I do think he has good hands, but he needs to have more awareness in those types of situations, and he'll get that with more experience. But that was that sequence, I agree with you. That was the game right there. And it started with John Fox punting, and it ended that sequence with, you know, a touchdown after that big play by Matthew Stafford.
Hmm. 4-10, like I said, the Niners have kind of pushed ahead of the Bears, meaning that the Bears have a better draft pick because they lost to the Niners and they have the same record now. Where are we? I mean, are we inching with this loss to go to 4-10? Are we inching back into lotto pick top five area when it comes to the NFL draft next year?
Well, the problem is, I believe they're at number 6 right now, if the season ended today, but they still have played such a tough schedule this year. And that's
right.
The tiebreak.
It hurts them, right?
It doesn't matter that they lost to the 49ers. It is the 49ers are getting the better pick right now because of the strength of schedule. And
that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's ridiculous if you two teams played each other and the one team that lost gets a less? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it seems like the team that loses should get the better pick in a head-to-head situation.
Just like a catch is a catch. And so what, did the ball came out at the end of that Pittsburgh?
Oh, man. I could have done half the hour on that situation.
We're not. It's like, as a Bears fan, I'm like, I don't care about other controversies in the NFL right now. I don't care. it's Bears or nothing, but it's just, right. But, yeah, so the Bears, I mean, they go into Cleveland comes to Soldier Field on Sunday, Christmas Eve. My Facebook feed is full of two tickets. Anyone want to get rid of these tickets?
Yeah.
I mean, there's you know, Rosenblatt was talking about, you know, whether or not they should boycott the game, fans should do a no-show. I mean, is there any feel about that, about the idea that this is the last home game at Soldier Field for a team that Bears fans are not happy with?
Yeah, I don't think there'll be a boycott or anything like that, but I think it'll be a lot like last year's game against Washington on Christmas Eve. I'm trying to see if I can get that attendance right now for you, because I remember there was a ton of empty seats in Soldier Field for that game. I'm not seeing it at this second, but I think it'll be similar, where there was, okay, they said the paid attendance was almost 58,000.
Yeah.
There's no
way. Paid's way different than who shows up.
So. Yeah, I want to say, and that's well below actually sellout, just at 58. So in terms of people in their seats, it must have been in the 30s. And I would imagine something similar, because the weather's supposed to be really cold, too. It was actually warm on Christmas Eve last year, if you remember. It's going to be really cold on Sundays. So you're going to go see them play the Browns in the freezing cold on Christmas Eve. If you're looking for tickets on the cheap right now, because there's probably some people out there that want to get in cheap and know they can, I would wait. Because like you just said, Justin, I think people are being giving these things away.
I've been buttering up the wife to be like, you know, it'd be a fun Christmas Eve thing to do. And then and she ain't having it.
Hey, she's not right. It. It's not going to be fun, it's Justin. Not let your brain trick you into thinking it's going to be fun. You're going to be cold. You're going to be watching a bad football game. Don't let it happen.
Adam Hogue, of course, the man who covers the Chicago Bears for WGN. Find all his stuff at WGNradio.com/Bears. And, of course, the Monday Evening Quarterback. I think this is our last one, because we'll be out Christmas and New Year's. So we'll have to check in right after the new year on how the final two games went. Adam, a pleasure. Happy holidays, and thanks for joining us, man.
You too. Happy holidays, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It is a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9:30, Scott Smith's going to join us, our new media contributor. We're going to talk about the... What an interesting day in social media, whether it's Facebook saying that, yes, they admit that their platform makes us depressed, or Twitter finally, under intense scrutiny, cracking down on hate speech and other violations on their platform. So definitely tune in for that. It's coming up at 9:30. And then Big Sadie is here, the roots music, country music. They're doing a country Christmas coming up at the Hideout on Thursday, and they're going to perform live. And I believe they bought the banjo player, which is great. Holiday music via banjo coming up here on the download. Well, it's time for Industry Night, our Monday night segment that explores the world of food and hospitality in the Chicagoland area. Last week, we talked restaurants data profiling you. And before that, Deb Perlman was in to talk about her cookbooks and her great site, The Smitten Kitchen. You can find those segments and others at WGNradio.com. So search the hashtag Industry Night tonight. It's a pleasure to welcome one of the best beverage directors, bar owners, and mixologists working today. Danny Shapiro is one of the minds behind the Logan Square Gin Bar, Scofflaw. Scofflaw is a must visit for anyone who partakes in the craft cocktail scene here in Chicago. It's been open since 2012. And it's not just that bar. He's also the man behind Slippery Slope, Heavy Feather, and the new bar, The Moonlighter, which just opened up across the street from Scofflaw, right there in Armitage. Shapiro and his partners are dedicated in Logan Square, and they're a big part of the dining scene that's transformed the near Northwest Side neighborhood. And it's a pleasure tonight to talk craft cocktails, bar menus, and Logan Square with Danny Shapiro. Danny, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to meet you. I feel like I've met you already through your drinks.
Thank
you.
Not
going to lie to you. I've been to Scofflaw many a time.
I appreciate it.
All right, so let's go back to 2012. Let's just start with Scofflaw, because that I think of Logan Square, and there's a lot of great bars and a lot of places that have become fixtures in the dining scene here in Chicago, and Scofflaw is part of that. So take us back to why you settled in Logan Square in 2012.
Yeah, so at the end of 2011, my partners and I had the opportunity to purchase a business in Logan Square called Streetside, and the owners of that business were, you know, they had done what they sought out to do, and they were ready to move on. So we purchased the business from them at the end of 2011, and then we kind of ran the business as is for a few months just to get a feel of
what kind of business was it?
It was a bar and grill, so it was kind of like a typical neighborhood spot. And we wanted to spend some time in the space and figure out the things that were working, the things that weren't working, so that we could breathe new life into the space. So we ran it pretty much from the end of December through January. We closed for the month of February to do renovations and all that stuff. It was very hands-on. We lived inside the space. there were some dark times for sure, but I think ultimately we believed in the concept that we were opening. We had to. And on March 12th, we opened our doors officially.
I mean, was the goal along with the partners, were you looking at a goal with a craft cocktail bar? The idea of let's do something that Chicago doesn't have a lot of, especially when it comes to just gin, like a gin cocktail bar?
Yeah. So at the time, we felt that Chicago could use a gin-focused cocktail bar that had really great food and American craft beers on tap. I had come from the Whistler where there were great cocktails, a great program over there, but there wasn't a food component. So that might have like planted, you know, that was one component that we were contemplating. And then, yeah, I mean, I think we just kept like bouncing ideas off each other. We were, again, around each other 24/7. And we were kind of naive enough to pursue the concept as we saw fit. And it was all about like hitting an $8 price point. So when we opened, right, it was like all the cocktails were $8. All the food items were $8. Like the value is pretty crazy. And I think deep down, we knew that people would connect to it. Maybe we didn't have that kind of confidence on the surface, but I think there was a part of it where we knew we were kind of onto something, I guess.
How was the challenge of creating the menu? And because I always think about that, even with your work at the Whistler and being a guy who commanded the menus, having your own restaurant and having your own experience and saying, this is going to be mine and I'm going to put every drink that's on here is going to be my creation. I'm going to talk about the emotions that go into that kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of nerve-wracking. Luckily at the Whistler, I was in like the passenger seat. I was mostly observing. So I had a lot of time to like collect my own ideas and things that I wanted to implement, you know, in the off chance that I would one day have my own cocktail menu to preside over. And I think the luckiest component or the greatest part was that the neighborhood was so accepting of the challenges that we were taking or the leaps that we were making. And yeah, it was just like, I don't know, I think I was just trying to be in the zone. I was very focused. I wasn't necessarily thinking about what would play really well to like the majority of a potential demographic. Mm-hmm. We were making things that we really enjoyed. And I think that is kind of the basis for Scofflaw Group, like setting out to do concepts that we ourselves are really passionate about and that make us happy. And the hope is that people respond, you know.
Is it hard when you're a restaurant group and you've had success with Scofflaw and you want to do your own projects? You know, you said something that's personal to you and you want to be creative. But at the same time, you started in 2012 in Lincoln or in Logan Square, and that neighborhood has exploded.
Yeah.
Do you say, hey, you know what this neighborhood needs is a sports bar? Let's do sports bar. You know, no one wants to do a sports bar, but let's do it. Meaning, do you see like the dollar signs in the way that, yes, you're one of the indigenous restaurants of that dining, the new dining scene, but you know, there is a difference between personal projects and trying to do something that's for everybody.
Sure, I think that's a fair point. I think that, yeah, in the beginning, you know, we followed concepts that, I mean, I don't know. I think that even with the Moonlighter, whereas we saw an opportunity, we still are passionate about that concept. A place to watch sports where we can get a good cocktail, great beer selection, a lot of sours, and obviously excellent food from Mickey, our chef, who is our opening chef for Scofflaw. So the way that it's kind of come full circle has been really nice to see. But yeah, as far as, you know, are we more calculating or do we think more of the business side now? I think that we had to learn to run our businesses leaner just to survive. And that's like an ongoing process. Mm-hmm. It is something that we have not perfected, but every day we try to go out there and, yeah, I mean, the business components are kind of an everyday.
Yeah. Danny Shapiro is with me tonight, the bar owner, the restaurateur, the beverage director, mixologist, one of the best in Chicago who, I think we've been talking about the Scofflaw in Logan Square, but also the new one that just opened up, the Moonlighter. You know, I think about Scofflaw and I can't help but notice how many cocktail bars, craft cocktail bars, have exploded in the last 5 years. I mean, there's a time where you just walk across the street and there's three of them. And not a lot of them last. I mean, they kind of go in and they go out. What, in your estimation, is the the secret ingredient to keeping a restaurant or a cocktail bar open. I mean, you guys are coming up. You're coming up on this to 5 year. You just passed the five.
Yeah, almost at six.
Yeah, March. So I mean, you know, you've had success in doing it. What do you think it is that keeps you guys in business where others can't keep up?
I think putting value first, even at the Moonlighter, which just opened. You know, it's 5 years after Scofflaw opened, five and a half, whatever. And you'd expect like the price point to go up pretty significantly, but we're still doing like cocktails for, you know, $10. And I think that's pretty affordable if you look at the city as a whole. And I think delivering a great value and having great service are kind of the two most important things mm-hmm. for us. Hospitality first. A joke slogan that I like to kind of say is warm hospitality and cold drinks, but I don't know how much my partners like that slogan. But you know, I think that at the end of the day, the thing that sets us apart or the reason that we've been able to survive is that we have really great people working for us, working with us, and they make people feel welcome and people want to return to places where they're welcome.
Yeah. And Scofflaw does it because it's a neighborhood bar in Logan Square, but it also appeals to a lot of Chicago. I don't live in Logan Square, and I've been there many a time. You know, I had this question. It's just a curiosity of mine, and I was thinking about this when we were getting ready for the segment. The concept of service in a craft cocktail bar. There's right. so much passion and care that goes into making a drink, and with that time. Right? Let's just be honest about it, that if I'm going to order one of your drinks, it's going to take a little bit longer than you slinging an old-fashioned real quick and putting it out on the bar.
Yeah.
The bars get crowded. They get packed. I mean, there is a process that you have to go through to order. We see in some of the other Logan Square bars along that, you know, people can't get in and there are reservations, all that kind of stuff. I mean, how do you, as a bar director, as someone who's opens restaurants and has succeeded in the craft cocktail space, balance that idea that there's craft and there's care with the base core things that we expect as customers when it comes to service and speed and things of that nature that others know from other bars?
Yeah, I think one secret that may not be so secret is that we're willing to have labor costs that are a little bit higher than probably the average fancy cocktail bar, the average place, so we have more people interacting with guests, so that ratio is pretty good. Our bar setup is unique in that each person behind that bar is qualified to interact with the guest. Like there's not a person who's just like a head down bar back who isn't supposed to make eye contact right. with guests.
My favorite, excuse me, no, you can't, okay, sorry.
Yeah, so I think that kind of promotes quicker interactions. People aren't waiting as long. Each day we're trying to make it more efficient without sacrificing quality. So that's something that we talk about all the time. We still discuss it.
Yeah, but know, I mean, you have to, do you think about the, like you just said, do you think about the design of the bar? Do you think about, do you have to start thinking about, hey, these drinks take a little bit of time. We want volume, obviously, because we want it, we're a business. We want people, but how do you get them in and out?
Yeah. So one of the things that we implemented when we started Scofflaw was that the cocktail menu had 8 drinks and it was split in 2. So 4 of the drinks were made by the North service well, and then 4 of the drinks were made by the South service well. And the reason that we did this is to increase the amount of times that we could multiply drinks. So when we could multiply drinks more throughout a service, we could make them more efficiently. So we can make, you know, up to 3 of something at a time rather than one
and then you go back to the next order, right?
Yeah, so
that's interesting.
So that was just like
one, you got to think about those things, right?
Innovation.
I would never think that bar owners are thinking about that, because you've been in those spaces where you're like, but it's good to know that the guys at the cocktail bar are thinking about it.
Yeah, we're sensitive to the getting people's attention when we're out at bars as well.
You know, I think of are we at a point, I think of as I mentioned, you know, just a couple years ago, you walk down Michigan Avenue, there'd be cocktail bars here and there. Are we at a point where that's going to continue? Do you think that there will be more cocktail bars opening up and keep going in that tradition because it's been successful? It's a proven sort of entity? Or are we at the jump the shark kind of moment where maybe it's craft beers or maybe it's going in a different direction and the idea of that cocktail bar is something of the past?
I don't know that we will see fewer cocktail bars in the future. I think you'll just see more concepts borrowed from more places. Like with social media and just like the ubiquity of posts on Pinterest or whatever on Instagram, people can see what's happening in other cities and they're like, oh, that's a cool concept from Florence. I want to do my own aperitivo cafe bar in Chicago or whatever the concept seems to be. So I think you'll just see like a more diverse selection of concepts. And I don't know that they'll always be geared toward craft cocktails because, yeah, maybe most people think like it's been done. What's the next thing? And yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like most of the major kind of subcategories of craft cocktails have been done in this city, at least.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's tiki or like a 70s throwback or, you know, whatever.
Theme in any sort. Yeah. And I always wonder because Chicago has an adventurous palate, one that probably is diminished, that, you know, stereotypically diminished, where everyone thinks that we're just a steak and potatoes type town and you know, you're not, but it's proven over and over and over that restaurants with themes or new concepts in food or bars with new concepts just attract flocks of customers. So where is Chicago rate when it comes to craft cocktails and the adventurous palates of drinkers?
Yeah, I would argue that it rates at the top only in that if you want to go to a place, to a cocktail bar anywhere and get good service and great quality product, I think Chicago is your best bet. I think that the people here are very open-minded and willing to try anything. I think when we first opened Scofflaw, we were nervous whether or not our drinks would be, you know, too challenging for people in the neighborhood. But from day one, people were just like, cool, it's on the menu, like I'll try it. And we sell, you know, the majority of what we sell are cocktail menu cocktails.
Yeah. I think of Logan Square, of course, and I remember popping out when I went to Jason's restaurant, Giant, right there.
Yeah, so
right next to you guys, right?
Yep.
And it was amazing. Like I popped out and I remember, I think it was in an Uber, and I was like, I don't know where I'm at. Like I have lost, like this is not the Armitage I know. Like I popped out and it took me a second to get my bearings. I mean, there's been a lot of change in Logan Square, especially when it comes to new businesses and the dining scene. Do you feel it? Do you have to keep up with it? I mean, obviously you have doubled down and made your anchor that neighborhood.
Yeah.
But I mean, how do you see Logan Square developing and evolving coming up in the next 5 to 10 years?
That's a great question. I'm super excited to have stuff like Giant and Best Intentions and Damn Fine Coffee around us. And I look forward to more and more things coming to that stretch and making it, you know, more legitimate in the eyes of the rest of the city. And yeah, I don't know. It's really cool to see the changes. I don't really have, I don't know that I can predict what exactly is coming, but stuff like Tusk is great too, because it's like in the retail direction and mm-hmm. it adds to what's going on. And it's not just like bars and restaurants, but there's like, you know, some shopping, there's Festive Collective, there's, you know, pretty wide range of things.
You know, as we wrap up, I mean, it is interesting because Logan Square has had such a tremendous history in this town of changing and evolving, and it's been a lot of neighborhoods to a lot of different people. And Logan Square is at the center, and it always seems to be in the last 10 years, of a gentrification fight, right? Of the idea of people moving in. And places like Scofflaw and others along Armitage, you guys are almost the first wave, if you will, or second wave, if people coming through. Do you sense a connection to the neighborhood, to the past? Do you find yourself, sort of dealing with that, the fact that you guys are bringing something different to a neighborhood that was already there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're conscious of it. We try to remain connected to it in that, you know, at the Moonlighter, for example, we offer a carrot cake on our menu that comes from Roser's Bakery, which has been in the neighborhood for over 100 years on North Avenue in Kedzie. So we try to support the businesses that have existed and weathered much more than we have. And yeah, I think that kind of hammering home that point about value is important to us. It is a way for us to not alienate the neighborhood and to make sure that anyone is comfortable coming into our spots and ordering food and not, you know, not feeling out of place.
Right. My last question is just, what's the worst gin? You know, like, I got the gin guy in studio. What's the worst gin? Like, I see a lot of gins and I'm like, that label looks wrong. Should I get it? What's the worst gin?
The worst gin is an empty bottle. Yeah, I don't know. The worst gin is, I don't know. That's,
you don't know.
It's
too
tough.
Yeah. It's too tough.
I can answer.
Won't go on record. We're trying to get you on record. Right? Yeah. Danny Shapiro is the he's a beverage director. He's a bar owner. He's a restaurateur with Scofflaw Groups. Of course, the gin bar Scofflaw. We've also got Slippery Slope, Heavy Feather, and the new bar, the Moonlighter, which is right across the street from Scofflaw. It was a 3204 Armitage, West Armitage, in the northwest, near northwest side neighborhood of Logan Square. Danny, great to meet you. Like I said, I feel like I already know you through the drinks that I've had in your establishments.
Well, thank you. Great to meet you.
I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Rob. Big Bulls win. There you go. Six in a row. We'll take that. Yes. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Studio 435. Big Sadie. Country Christmas. We're going to be at the Hideout on Thursday night. And the... I what do you call them, Pete? I've got acoustic American roots music. Maybe a little country. I mean, they call their show Country Christmas. But Country Christmas. And we had them in here before. You got a banjo. You got an upright bass. You got a fiddle, guitar. It's some good stuff. It's acoustic jam. So it'll be fun tonight. I'm looking forward to having them in here to sing holiday songs. Country Christmas coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. I mean, come on. Who does that? Country Christmas. I mean, Patty's got Clarinet Christmas, which is coming up in her show. I heard the promo. So there you go.
You know, like a Johnny Cash, Dolly Parton throwback kind of situation.
I'm and in that same spirit, I'm going to be four... whiskey.
Yep.
Whiskey's in.
Yeah. Oh, that's a Chris Christopherson Christmas, actually. Yeah, that's a little different.
A little different.
That's a little different.
All right. So, you know, we've been talking about this all night. Scott Smith in studio, our new media contributor here to the Download. We're going to talk a little bit about social media news today, including Twitter and their crackdown, but also a question about what to look for when we talk about digital news in 2018. Scott joins us on the regular. He's the editorial director.
That's right, over at Teamworks Media.
Yeah. Good to see you, buddy. Thanks
good
for
to see
being
you.
Here. Happy holidays.
Always good to be
all
here.
All right, so let's get right to the social media stuff. This kind of went in one ear, out the other, but it's kind of the first big move for Twitter to crack down on hate speech and, I guess, incendiary tweets, both. And I thought this was really interesting. Both in the tweets, but also in profile, the profile names, so what you name your Twitter account, they're actually responding to the kind of, I guess, the all the dirt that's online right now and gets dusted up when things happen in this country.
Yeah, I mean, they've deleted some accounts before. I mean, Chuck Johnson was kind of famously kicked off Twitter. Milo was famously kicked off Twitter, one of the alt-right guys. So they've kind of done it on a piece-by-piece way. And now they are trying to create new rules around the kinds of things you can and can't say. And so, you know, anything that could be considered hate speech or threatening or, you know, singling out specific groups, rolled these rules out. And today was supposed to be the great
purge,
the great alt-right purge.
Right.
And it kind of wasn't. It, you know, there were a few accounts, most famously a couple of the people that had been a part of the Britain First movement, which is a very far-right, nationalist, Nazi-ish kind of account. It was sort of well-known because the president
had retweeted
some videos.
These are the Muslim videos that came out a couple
right.
weeks ago, yeah.
So, you know, a couple of very high-profile folks there, and then, you know, a couple of other people here and there, but it sort of remains to be seen whether... You know, the Richard Spencers of the Twitter universe, the sort of alt-right, the kind of, you know, pretty boy Nazi types are actually going to be affected by
and
this.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that they put in the language of what they would consider when they're considering banning people from the platform is what you do outside of Twitter. Before, there was this idea that you could be anything, you could do anything, and if you behaved yourself on the platform, who are they to judge? But they have changed that, and they're saying if you are a leader of a hate group or you're not on Twitter, we're not going to let you on this platform.
One of the complaints that people have had about the way that Twitter has approached this kind of thing before is that these folks would hide behind the idea that they aren't necessarily inciting hate, inciting violence, and but they would use their different ways of interacting with people to kind of sick followers on a particular person, knowing that those people would then end up, you know, saying all kinds of hateful things against them. And they would say, well, look, I didn't actually tell them to do it. I didn't actually say it. But, you know, everyone knew the way in which they might at a particular person or, right, you know, quote tweet a particular person, that they knew kind of what they were doing. So this is, I think, one of the steps in order to get them to try to crack down on some of the people who are in the, you know, inciting the various Twitter mobs. The one problem is that this, you know, singles out maybe some of the higher profile folks, but, you know, it's really easy to continue to create additional profiles and, you know, dump, you know, almost like burner profiles, right?
Yeah.
You dump a profile and then you start up another one. So that kind of stuff, how do you end up creating?
And I mean, I would assume, there's so many. And I guess if you think of Facebook and YouTube, they're ahead of the game a little bit. Instagram as well, where they have already set up parameters to avoid that kind of stuff. And Twitter has kind of been the wild, wild west in terms of. So I could see that they could follow actual precedent from some of the other social media platforms. But, you know, I mean, there's just a lot going on, right? There's a lot going on Twitter when you talk about people who are not famous or not high profile with 50 followers or, you know, who want to say something to a politician or want to say something.
And it's not just, you know, saying something. I think we kind of forget the idea that, oh, well, why don't you just stop listening to them or why don't you just block them? Or it's, you know, tweeting you pictures of the, you know, worst, you know, awful pictures of violence and gore and all these kinds of things. And yes, you could block one, but then another one keeps popping up. And at what point do you stop and say, this is actually not doing anything for me anymore? And that's, I think, one of the things that Twitter has started to realize is that their growth is not because people don't understand how to use Twitter. It's not like people have like not figured out how to thread tweets. It's, oh, there's actually Nazis here, and there are, you know, people being awful racist and you know, sexist and misogynist and all these various ists. And at some point, you say, you know, if that was a bar, you would stop going to that bar. You know, you would just be like, I really like the drinks here, but there are a lot of Nazis here. And a fair amount of white supremacists, and
fair amount.
I think I'm just going to go to a different. I'm just not going to come to this bar anymore.
People realize that, right?
And it just, particularly for people of color, particularly for women, it's far, far worse. So at some point, I think Twitter started to realize, this sort of throw open the doors and let the tweets flow kind of approach has made it the usefulness for Twitter. Or of Twitter for some people, just kind of gone away.
Yeah, and obviously the big elephant in the room is the president. The president has been an avid user of Twitter.
That's an avid user. That's a
and has done exactly some of the things that Twitter's cracking down on, the incendiary stuff and online bullying and what have you. I mean, obviously they're not going to do anything to his account, but I wonder how much response there's going to be from Trump followers and from Trump supporters that see this to be a biased move by Twitter to clean up what they see or deem to be bad speech or bad behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's Twitter is in a situation where, you know, they sort of can't win. You know, I mean, if they take even the slightest steps toward, you know, cracking down on hate speech, people are going to cry censorship. So it really doesn't matter how delicate the move is that they make. You know, they're going to get those cries anyway, because it's sort of, look, if you are speaking to a group of people who seems like they are oppressed in some way or that their views are belittled, what better way to kind of rile those folks up to say, like, look at this huge tech company with all this money. They're trying to get
take
rid of you.
Voice,
like,
yeah.
We are the haven for you at Breitbart or wherever it is. Yeah. So, I mean, you're just going to continue to have those folks who are going to make hay out of whatever you do. So is it better to at least be able to create a space that hews a little bit more towards what you wanted to do, which is create a place that, you know, people can have, you know, decent conversations and discuss the news of the day and that kind of thing. Yeah. So
Scott Smith in studio. He's our new media contributor. When we talk about social media, we have to also mention Facebook. Big story today, which was a little bit of a head scratcher because you and me both thought this already happened at one point. But they said they're going to start demoting posts where people are just fishing for likes.
Right. So we've seen this whole thing where, you know, comment if you this or like this post if you something else, you know, that kind of thing.
Or my posts over and over. Do I look pretty?
Right.
I do that one over and over.
I saw yours last week.
I haven't blocked it yet. That's
I liked
good.
It. I said I liked it, yeah. You know, this is interesting to me for two reasons. One, I kind of already thought that other algorithmic changes they made had kind of knocked this off. But it comes on the heels of a study that surprisingly Facebook actually talked about on its official company blog that said it was a couple different studies. One that said that the headline most people went with was, you know, using Facebook makes you depressed. And that's not just if you're looking at your ex's Facebook profile. It's just in general. But what they found is that people who use Facebook in this very sort of surface way, like they kind of scroll and scroll and they might like some things or they might click on some links, but they don't actually engage with it in any meaningful way. Like they don't leave comments or they don't post terribly meaningful updates.
Right,
they don't actually talk to people, if you will.
Right.
You know, then those people are more likely to be depressed. But people who are actually getting into it and having conversations, and maybe they are in sort of groups, you know, Facebook groups with people who share their interests,
sure,
have kind of found their own niche communities, those folks actually report that they enjoy Facebook more.
Me and Mike McNamara from the Midwest Film Festival will get on Facebook during Bears games to complain. So, yeah, I understand. There's a value to it.
Right. Now one, there has not been a study that shows people who are on Facebook during Bears games, if they are more depressed. There has not been that study. I want to clarify. But, yeah, look, having somebody to kind of talk about something like that and go back and forth, you do get that kind of social interaction.
Well, isn't that the whole
kind of
dopamine hit? That's the weird thing about this, and why it's still we're still in the guinea pig phase of social media because the concept of Facebook is that we're going to connect you. We're going to connect you. We're going to have friends. Mm-hmm. We're going to make your life more enriched by having connections with your friends and family. Right? That's the concept. That's the ideal.
Yeah.
And now studies come out saying it's actually doing the opposite. And the Facebook and a Facebook exec, which was a dumb story from last week, said, "Yeah, Facebook's probably it's tearing society apart."
Right.
I mean,
right.
You're starting to get this idea where there's like, you know, maybe this social media experiment is just that maybe we need to get rid of all this stuff.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there, right? I mean, most tech companies and most engineers, I would say, even are sort of approaching things from. Engineers are going to say, look, we're going to create the tools. We're going to put the product together. The product is you know, emotion neutral. It is value neutral. What people do with it is a different concern. Well, that's the concern of the people that are the UX folks down the hall. And you're starting to see actually a lot of technology companies now employing folks in the humanities, folks in you know, behavioral sciences that can actually tell people, look, this is how people are going to use your product. This is what we're kind of, you know, seeing now as these tech companies get their tendrils and, you know, to all manner of society. But the other aspect of it is, too, is that most technology companies and most of the folks that kind of are part of, you know, venture capitalist scenes and things like that have this sort of free market rules all kind of thing, right? And so the market will decide. And this has been kind of what a sort of variation of that argument is what Twitter has used in the past, is that, you know, the folks on the platform will decide what is okay and what is not okay.
Yeah.
And what we've seen is that technology companies can employ these algorithms, but the algorithms are only as good or as bad as the human beings that are creating them. So there is a value system put in place about what kind of voices do you want to make sure kind of rise to the top or which ones don't. You know, but going back to Facebook, in that idea of how you use it you know, is going to make you depressed. You think of it like if you were at a really terrible party and you were surrounded by people who were talking, but you were not actually talking with any of them, and you were just sort of over in the corner looking like you were, you know, furiously studying the person's bookshelves or something like that. Like, you'd be like, this is I'm depressed. I need to leave. This is like a terrible party. And that's probably the you know, comparison to what Facebook is saying. Like, somebody that just kind of is hanging out and not really engaging and, you know, da-da-da-da. But, you know, I think you're right. We are in this very beginning phase of looking at the effects of these technology apps. And what's the value? And look, there are plenty of people who say, you know, I was in a crisis situation. I was dealing with something I didn't know how to deal with. And I reached out online and I found people who helped me through it. And I found a real connection there. And that still exists. But when you get to a point where you've said, you know, anybody can put an ad on our platform in any form, and, you know, the only thing we'll say is you can't have too much text on the picture. If that's the only limitation of an ad, you have situations like you had last year where foreign entities can come in and influence the way a particular election is, you know, is conducted.
Or at least attempt to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether or not there's any proof, it's the concept that that space that we're created, and like you mentioned, free market and everything, right, and what people want out of it, is being co-opted more often than we know. And that leads to the emotional part where you're like, I'm not enjoying this experience because I'm being inundated with stuff that is trying to get me to think one way or not think one way. And that's not why I signed up for this in the first place. It's not why I signed up for Friendster.
Right.
You know, when it first started. So Scott Smith in studio, editorial director at Teamworks Media and also our new media contributor. All right. Let's talk about 2018, man. What a year for media. And the biggest story, of course, was the shuttering of digital news product DNA Info and Chicagoist and Gothamist and everything in there. And I read a story, and they continue to pop up, that 2018 looks bleak for digital news. And we're talking about companies that aren't the big dogs, that don't just have an arm. You know, what we've seen is with big gobble-ups where, you know, now you have every TV station has a digital arm. But we're talking about indigenous digital, whether it be BuzzFeed or Gawker, as we saw, who's now defunct. Mm-hmm. It's not the a lot of people say that, and we talked about it after the demise of DNA, that the billionaire route is not sustainable, and right now they still have yet to find a workable system of finance that is going to keep this industry afloat.
Right. I mean, there's been two things. So one is the idea of chasing scale for scale's sake. I think this was the year that the lie was put to that concept. You know, everybody knows that if you throw some, you know, paid dollars at social media, or you get involved with folks who are sort of professionally creating platforms to help kind of boost your traffic, you can get those eyeballs. You can, you know, make sure you have the promise to your advertisers fulfilled. But what we found is, you know, that those folks are still just kind of drive-by traffic. You know, those folks are not going to develop any kind of loyalty to you. But the other thing is that, you know, like most things in digital media, the display market is just, you know, cratering. And programmatic advertising, the idea that you can basically turn all the ads over on your website or your platform over to, you know, robots and a sort of back-end system that allows all of the – there's no direct sales anymore, that you can turn that all over to automation is driving the price of digital ad down, along with what we've seen over the last couple of years, which is Google and Facebook are now eating up like 80% of digital revenue because a lot of folks realize they can just go direct to – search engines or Facebook as being the biggest social platform.
Do you think, and I don't want to make, because it's fascinating what you're talking about, but the aside, that one of the things that they did not foresee in the digital news industry at the startup was how predatory Facebook and Google were going to be in gobbling up ads and being able to go for advertisers to go, why don't I just go to search engines? Why do I need to attach it to content? I mean, that's that at a certain point may have been undervalued, or not undervalued, but under aware might be the word, because these companies are eating digital news is lunch.
I think what the biggest thing that publishers did to, you know, hasten their demise was not so much see that Google and Facebook were going to eat up all that revenue, right? Or that, you know, the Facebook was going to be the frenemy and all that kind of stuff. It was deciding that it was okay for platforms like Apple and Facebook and Google to get more control over the interaction they have with the customer. The idea that as long as they continue to get page views and uniques and all that kind of stuff, that they would be able to make that money up in digital revenue and just decide that they could walk away from subscribers and walk away from an actual customer that they had a, you know, ongoing relationship with.
And a proven model.
Right, right. That was, I think, the biggest mistake. And I'm not one of those people that thinks that everything on the internet needs to be free, but I'm also not one of those people who thinks everything needs to be behind a paywall either. I think something like, you know, DNA Info, Chicagoist, that's a very local model. It's really difficult to make that work. Chicagoist was profitable before they were bought by DNA Info. So that was a place that was creating a local model that actually worked because they were in a bunch of different cities. They had a national market. There was a question of how far you could actually take that. Yeah. But, you know, for most places, you know, they're not going to be big enough to get that kind of scale. The generalist news site is going away. The niche news site is actually the one that's taking its place. And they are realizing, and I say niche, and it's still like, you know, 3 to 5 million uniques a month on the low end, you know, up to, say, even 15 on the high end. But those folks are really realizing that subscriptions are really where they're going to make their money. I just saw today that The Atlantic, which had dropped its paywall, and it is really seen as one of the few digital publishing success stories, particularly around the kind of native content that they do. They're putting their paywall back up again. They are really kind of following, you know, you said their billionaire model doesn't really work. It does if you're Jeff Bezos and you're pushing the Washington Post to have a really tight paywall. And we're seeing sites like the Boston Globe, which are smaller, implement a paywall. And
Chicago
actually,
Tribune, right?
The Chicago Tribune are reinvigorating the idea that the work they do has value.
Well, let me ask about this. We can wrap after this, but the Sun-Times then falls in, a company that does not have a paywall, that has ads all over the place. It needs an upgrade on the website and everything. But a company that Edward Eisendrath and the owners of the Sun-Times have said, hey, we're going to win in the digital space. I mean, they're an outlier in the way that they have a brand, they have subscriptions, they have everything you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Can 2018's kind of make or break for them, right?
Yeah, this is the year they've, you know, when they got bought, they had about 2 years of runway in the money that they had raised. So 2018's really going to be the year that, you know, by, I would say, the end of the first quarter, they have to demonstrate that they are, like, where they're headed digitally. And the thing that they're going to need to do is demonstrate not just that they're, like, throwing up a paywall and, you know, what have you. They're really going to have to demonstrate an idea of what it is that Sun-Times about. Eisendrath has said that they are for the working person of Chicago, and somebody needs to be getting their back. That's a great idea to rally around, particularly as all of these other sites are getting gobbled up by these kind of big behemoths and things like that. But they're also going to need to demonstrate that they are filling a niche inside a community or communities. I think they have an opportunity to really, you know, speak to areas of the South and West Side that often do not get the kind of coverage, and certainly aren't getting the kind of coverage now that DNA Info has gone away, that, you know, really makes a thriving community. I mean, I see it. I live on the South Side. I live in Morgan Park. And we have a Beverly Review, which has been there for 100 plus years, but we also had DNA Info down there too. And I've seen the kind of, you know, vacuum that occurs in a neighborhood when you don't have news kind of regularly being fed into the people that live there. It's not just about usefulness. It's not just about knowing what's going on in your community, but it's actually being connected to it in a way that makes you feel like, you know, you've got some agency over kind of the world around you. And I think if the Sun-Times can demonstrate that, look, we are not just here to throw news at you. We are actually here to be hearing from you and actually be creating something that has a level of utility for people who live in Chicago, then I think they're going to be really successful.
My last question, since I will probably not see you, New Year's Eve, are you going with the new NBC product, or are you sticking with Davies and Gene Greco?
I'm a Davies and Gene Greco. Old school, man. Come on. Oh, hey, look, there was that year that Jose Sanders showed up in those really, like, amazing cool.
Yeah.
cuffs.
Yeah, the cuffs. Yeah.
I mean, that was just like, this is what the reward you get as a fan for sticking with the team. I'm going to be there, man. I'm going to be live tweeting from my couch. That's how I do New Year's Eve, man.
I'm
over 40. That's my jam right now, man.
That is
your jam. Channel 5, I'm sorry that the... What the Chi-Town superstar
Rising,
town?
Yeah.
I don't know what is it. Yeah, the Chi-Town Rising. I couldn't remember.
Yeah,
it didn't stick in my head. Yeah. I'm Gene Greco and Davies. Jose Sanders.
All right.
The best party is always wherever Jose Sanders is, though.
Yeah.
You know this.
Right.
That's wherever he ends up.
That's
him and Val Warner are going to be out there. That's where it's going
to
be at.
I'm looking forward to it. Scott Smith, of course, our new media contributor here on The Download and the editorial director over at Teamworks Media. Scott, thanks so much, man.
Happy New Year, my friend.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Patty Vasquez taking over tonight. She's got clarinet Christmas music. Yeah. We've got country Christmas music. It's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio, all dressed up on Michigan Avenue. Tonight, a big Sadie Christmas. The American Roots Band is taking on the holidays with a new show at the Hideout coming up this Thursday night, the 21st. It's called Big Sadie Country Christmas. The band was in studio earlier this year to talk about their latest album, Keep Me Waiting. They are Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. One of Chicago's best back in studio, Big Sadie, to get us into the holiday spirit. Good to see everybody. Good to see you guys.
Hey,
I feel
Justin.
Like it's only been about 5 months.
Yeah, thanks for having us back.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me where this concert comes from, the idea of taking on Christmas favorites.
So Christmas is a small portion of the song selection that we're going to be playing on Thursday. Tonight we'll stick to the holiday tunes, but we play this as 4-piece. We were in the studio in May when our first album came out. All acoustic music, American roots, bluegrass influence, country is in there as well. But we've had this idea for a little while that we want to try to electrify it a little, just for fun, a one-off show. And so holiday season seemed like a really great time to bring in a little bit more of that classic country and some fun throwback holiday tunes.
Are you guys, because the last time we talked, I remember we were talking a lot about the history of the music and really getting into it. I always think about the history of holiday music when it comes to American roots and country music. And I was just kind of talking to you guys in the break about Johnny Cash and others who put on these big Christmas variety shows. Do you think about those kind of things when you think about putting on a show at the Hideout on a Thursday night, the big country Christmas?
Oh, certainly. This feels like a display, a variety show of sorts. We have three fantastic musicians joining us for the evening. We have Eric Hall on electric guitar. He plays in several rock bands based in Chicago. We have Sam Wagster on pedal steel for the night, and we have Joe Adamick on drums for the evening. So
yeah, Joe, we have him, yeah.
They are all really connected in Chicago music in very different genres, and we'll be bringing some really amazing energy. The rehearsals that we've had with them, everybody is really excited about the sound that's come out of that. So it does feel like a showcase of a wide variety.
And it's different for you guys
musicians.
Too, bringing the electric in, because you guys have performed acoustic over.
Definitely,
over your
we're career. We're an acoustic band.
You know, I wonder. I'm thinking about the Christmas songs. Let me ask: Do you find yourself gravitating to a kind of song that's going to sound in your wheelhouse? Meaning, are you looking for the country-inspired, American roots-inspired Christmas holiday tracks? Or can you guys big Sadie up Jingle Bells? Is it the idea that are you looking for a certain type of Christmas or holiday song, or can you do any in this style?
Yeah, We can do any in this style. We're using this as an excuse to play some cover songs that we really like, and some of those happen to be Christmas songs.
Good. I've always thought there needs to be fiddle and Jingle Bell Rock. Yeah, that kind of stuff. You could do it. See? There it is, right on cue. Big Sadie in studio tonight, Studio 435. We're going to hear some music coming up here in just a second. Yeah, I mean, how much does the Christmas holiday play into American roots music? I mean, are there a lot of albums and artists that have really doubled down on the idea of Christmas music and holiday music?
Certainly. I think pop country, which is not a big influence on what we play, but classic country, I'd say, is. Pop country has holiday spectaculars that air on national TV every year. And a lot of country stars have put out Christmas-specific albums. But we're kind of taking it to the throwback, like you mentioned, Johnny Cash doing a variety show. Tonight, we're going to play two songs, one that is a very Blue Christmas. It's a traditional holiday song, but another song called Just Because, and both are sort of the Elvis versions that we're doing tonight.
I was thinking Elvis would be someone who'd be the crossover because he just did so much Christmas stuff, right? Like at a certain point, it feels like the middle to the end of his career, it was just Christmas everything. Like that was all he was doing, right?
So we'll try to bring some of that Elvis spirit to the air tonight.
Yeah, I mean, we had an a cappella group in here last week, and I asked them the question because they were really, they were kind of tinkering with the arrangements of songs in different ways. You can do that with, vocal choirs. We talked about how these are not the easiest songs, that they're not as blue blood, four chord pop songs that you would think. There's a lot of different instrumentation, arrangement. There's a lot of change. I remember one of the guys said there's a lot of changing in the chord structure or the key changes in different places. They're not as easy as you think a third grade choir singing Jingle Bell Rock can get it.
Right. And the American roots music or country bluegrass, oftentimes it's three or four chords. And so how do you take a complex jazz standard and simplify it into a way that still sounds rich like those original Bing Crosby versions, but make them rich in their own way. And there is some overlap when we're playing American roots music. There definitely is some jazz influence at some point, or the swingy side of the swingy and bluesy side of bluegrass. So we played with that idea a little bit in some of these holiday arrangements.
Do you guys, as musicians, especially as Big Sadie, and obviously sitting down with the banjo and you got the fiddle there, do you like Christmas music? I mean, is it up there on the when you think about the different genres of music? Because that kind of it feels like that kind of music, and I'm not a musician. It gets played out real quick. Where I'm like, I'm done with the light. You know what I mean?
I love it. I could listen to it. I do listen to it all year round.
Really?
Oh yeah, like Frank Sinatra singing "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas." Like that. How could that ever get old? It's just fantastic music.
That's Matt talking, who also teaches at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Okay,
and if I have this in my mind correctly, you just taught a series of holiday songs to students. You did a couple of workshops that are Christmas specific.
It's true. On Saturday, I taught a Christmas Carols for the Banjo workshop, and you'd never believe that 13 people would fork over money to do it, but the room was packed, and they learned how to play We Three Kings and Christmas Time Is Here with all the jazzy chords, and Silent Night with harmony. And tonight in my fiddle class, we learned I Saw Three Ships Go Sailing In.
Wow.
And what was the other one I mentioned?
Well, there you go.
Oh, Tannenbaum, yeah. So
there's a crossover. The fiddle is made for Christmas music.
And the banjo too, wouldn't you say, Andy?
Absolutely.
There we go. Big Sadie in studio. The album Keep Me Waiting, we talked about back in May, and it's still out. I'll listen to it today. It's great. Get some good American roots blasting out the windows in the old house during the day. Big Sadie in studio, in Studio 435. They're going to play some holiday music tonight. They got their Big Sadie Country Christmas show at the Hideout coming up on Thursday, this Thursday the 21st. But they're here tonight, Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get some live music in Studio 435 with Big Sadie. Stay with us. Right.
It's Studio 435 here tonight on The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio, beautiful Michigan Avenue, which is decked. I guess, what do you call it? Decked the hall? Decked the Michigan Avenue halls? I don't know what it is, but it's decked for the holidays. In Studio 435 tonight, Big Sadie, the American Roots Band, will be playing a Big Sadie Country Christmas at the Hideout coming up on Thursday night. The band was in studio earlier this year, and we talked about their album, Keep Me Waiting. They're Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. They are back in studio tonight, and they are playing Christmas music for the season. So let's get right to it. Here they are, Blue Christmas. Take it away, guys.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll be so blue just thinking about you. Decorations of red on a green Christmas tree won't mean a thing, dear, if you're not here with me. And when those blue snowflakes start falling, when those blue memories start calling, you'll be doing all right with your Christmas of wine. I'll have a blue Christmas. You'll be doing all right
we go. Big Sadie in studio, 4:35 tonight, of course, with Blue Christmas. That'll be a big part of their show, Big Sadie Country Christmas, which is coming up here at the Hideout, coming up on Thursday night, December 21st. They are Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. We're going to get more music from you guys. I think what we'll do is we'll probably take a news break here coming up, and then we'll come back with the music since we're close to the bottom of the hour. All right. Thank you, Rob. Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here at Studio 435. Big Sadie is here, the American Roots Band, taking on the holidays with a new show at the Hideout coming up Thursday night called Big Sadie Country Christmas. They were here not too long ago. They are Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. We got the banjo. We got the upright bass. We got the fiddle. Acoustic guitar. It's kind of boring. You got to have something, right? All right. So we're going to hear some. We just heard Blue Christmas. Here comes another song, which isn't really necessarily a holiday song, but it does have a reference to Santa Claus. Here's Big Sadie, who will be at the Hideout on Thursday with the song Just Because. Take it away, guys.
Just because you think you're so pretty, just because you think you're so hot, just because you think you got something no other girl has got, you make me spend all of my money, laugh and call me old Santa Claus. Just because you think I'll be blue, just because you think I'll be foolish, stay at home and wait for you. You make me lose all of my girlfriends, laugh and call me old Santa Claus.
Great. Big Sadie in studio tonight, bringing us a little American Roots country jamboree, of course. This Thursday, the Big Sadie Country Christmas variety show will be at the Hideout, 1354 West Wabanzia, coming up, like I said, Thursday the 21st. Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, vocals on that one. Andy Malloy, Matt Brown, got the banjo and the fiddle down. Great stuff. They're second time through here this year. They were here with the album Keep Me Waiting. And again, that song called Just Because, which was holiday-ish because it got a couple Santa Clauses in there, right? But let's keep the train rolling. What do we want to hear? What do you guys got next? Let's go right into another song.
Great.
What do you got?
We're going to do an instrumental version of Silent Night. Matt Brown will will lead us on fiddle on
here
this
we
one.
Go Silent Night, Big Sadie, Studio 435. Go Big Sadie with the instrumental Silent Night. You had both Matt Brown and Andy Malloy rocking the fiddle and the banjo there. Don't know if that's the right word. Big Sadie Country Christmas is going to be at the Hideout. Come on down to the chairs. We'll talk a little bit more. They are Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. They'll be at the Hideout this Thursday, coming up the 21st for a Big Sadie Country Christmas, which will be a little bit different for you guys in the sense that you will have some electric musicians with you. Mostly you guys do acoustic. You know, watching the Silent Night, Matt, I gotta say, I mean, it reminds me, especially when it comes to the fiddle, that they're obviously you think about all the fiddle players kind of coming together. I had a friend of mine's dad who was a fiddle player in Missouri. And they would that's what they would do. They get together in the barn, and it'd be like 9 or 10 different fiddle players, and they play. And I realized that songs like Silent Night, some of the more popular kind of holiday classics, they fit right in. I mean, that you would not necessarily think that Silent Night could be played any other way than on the fiddle when you listen to you play it.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I mean, a lot of fiddle music is just about playing melodies that are communal and shared between people, and it could be, you know, all the same people in a town, or just songs that we all sing a certain time of the year. Mm-hmm. And the violin is one of the closest instruments to the human voice. So anything that you can sing, you could, you know, if you had a cold, you could just play it on the violin instead.
Right. Well, there's something to be said about that. I mean, you guys have always, you know, last time we were in here, impressed me with sort of knowledge of the music and where this music comes from, American roots. But there's something to be said about a lot of the same concepts of shared communal stories or songs being passed down from generation to generation. When we see our society now, when it comes to music, those are almost ultimately Christmas songs. I mean, that's where you see it cross over from not just historians, but regular common folk who, like, you know, jingle bells, it just get passed down from generation to generation.
Right. In bluegrass music or old-time music or spiritual music, the tradition is very much alive. But in popular culture, I haven't really thought about it that way before. But you're right. Christmas music is the traditional musical language that kind of...
I mean, that and Kanye West songs. But the idea that those are the right, two things that get passed down. Right. But no, there is something to it. I mean, what do you think it is? And I put it to you guys as somewhat musicians and historians that is the kind of music that gets passed down to generation to generation more than any other.
Well, it's a celebratory time of year. I know it's a hard time for some people, but the purpose of the season is to celebrate and be joyful. I mean, that's what a lot of the slogans are saying. That's what the message is, to come together, and music is a really great way to do that. So it seems like it's impossible for those songs and the idea of community not to penetrate that mm-hmm. idea of coming together and coming together around song.
Well, I ask you guys, because I don't know the answer. Maybe you don't either. But, you know, when we talk about the traditional songs, like even Silent Night being a good example, a song, a Christmas song that continues to get passed down generation to generation. Where are the origins of those songs? I mean, are they come from a certain religion? Do they come from a certain place? Can you route back to the Appalachian, you know, the trail and some of the music that was being played, you know, that you guys are keeping the spirit alive on?
As far as I know, Silent Night's a German hymn, Stille Nacht, from a couple hundred years ago. So it eventually came over to the Appalachian Trail, but I think it started in Germany.
So many of the Christmas songs that are most familiar to me, I think, are from the hymn tradition. Like,
yeah, church,
O Holy
right?
Night,
yeah,
Come right. Emmanuel, Joyful, Joyful. And I mean, you can talk about the holiday. We have a great Andy on Thursday is going to sing a song that the band did, Christmas Must Be Tonight, which is not one of these traditional tunes, but it touches on some of those mm-hmm. themes that are really present in the traditional Christmas hymns. But then the fun traditions of bringing some of the seasonal celebration that's not quite so religious, or you mentioned rocking around the Christmas tree.
Yeah, right.
Those keep it light and festive. So it's kind of fun to find the right intersection of that kind of faithful historical Christmas tradition and this fun, festive, colorful version of it.
You know, I think about, you know, when I earlier was talking about the Johnny Cash kind of experiences at the Grand Ole Opry, and they get all these country musicians, legends on stage to sing Children Go Where I Send Thee or something like that. They're just doing it. There seems to be a currency in the idea of the big variety shows and how they're attached to the country, to old country, right? This idea that there always was this kind of celebration around it. Is that a little bit of the idea of going with the big Sadie Country Christmas and putting it on stage at the Hideout to kind of reenact that in a small kind of way on the north side of Chicago?
I wouldn't necessarily take total credit for that, but I definitely, I mean, that's not what exactly was in my mind, but that this is an appropriate setting and an appropriate time of year to bring people together and showcase talents and do it in a fun, lighthearted, festive way. And we do have, we're splitting the vocals. Eric Hall will sing lead on one. We have another gal, special guest, who's joining us on harmonies on a couple of the songs. So it will have a little bit of that feel, even though it doesn't have the traditional format of a variety show where several artists will.
Yeah, no big collars, no leisure suits, none of that.
We haven't talked wardrobe yet.
TBD.
TBD. in studio tonight, Big Sadie, their show, Big Sadie Country Christmas, is coming up at the Hideout, coming up on Thursday night. The Hideout, of course, up on the north side on Wabanzia, 1354 Wabanzia. You know, when I think about it too, we talked about this last time, there is a really tremendous and growing roots scene in Chicago. When you think about sort of alt country or roots, and it does go around places like the Hideout. There are other shops as well that do this kind of stuff. And Old Town, of course, does a lot of work as well. But there does seem to be that this almost becomes the de facto American roots Christmas party. If you will, the Big Sadie Country Christmas becomes a place that you got. Do you guys kind of see it that way? That it's not just a concert. It's not just another show that you're on another stage. That there's something special with playing this music and doing it in a way to celebrate, as we just talked about, celebrate the time, the season, but also the community.
Certainly, and the gal that's singing with us plays in a group called Glass Mountain, which is a little bit more old time if you're talking genres, but still definitely in the American roots realm. The guest musicians that are playing with us are definitely on the rock side of things, but I think have an understanding and appreciation of the roots culture and are very connected to the Hideout and to this sort of extended musical family. So it does feel like bringing it together. And the initial concept was we wanted to experiment with this bigger band, electric sound, and we wanted to throw a holiday party, and we wanted to include a charitable component. So we're donating a portion of ticket sales to Marwin Foundation, which is not music related. They do visual arts for middle school and high school students. It's free after school classes. They just celebrated their 30th year, so it felt important to throw a party, have a celebration, celebrate the community, yeah. And also have a giving component.
You know, for you guys, I keep mentioning that you were here. We performed live in May because it was a release party for the Keep Me Waiting, which is what you guys were promoting at the time. Let's talk about it. I mean, what's next for you guys? When we talk about new music, new stuff that we can expect from Big Sadie in 2018?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, step up to the mic, Colin. Tell us all about it.
Oh, yeah. New music is on the way. In 2018, probably. We'll see when we make it into the studio. You know, you can't rush that kind of thing.
The time has to be right. When doing that, I mean, what is the early... When you start to think about putting new music together, what is the early steps for you? Like, take us through it. Does a demo start, or early you guys get start working?
For me personally, I'm usually, walking around the house and... T-shirt, and I'm playing the guitar, and I'm bothering Elise. What does this sound like? Sing this. Sing something with this. What does this sound like? And so then it goes from there, and it builds, and it has to, you know, it has to cross a certain threshold before we show these guys. You know, it has to make its way. There are plenty that live down here in the depths of our home. But then they make it out, and these guys help bring it to life.
When you have more than a T-shirt on.
Yeah, actually, fully clothed.
We have a dress code for band practice.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll expect new music from you guys then in 2018. You heard it here first. I'll take that out, put that, just make it go viral, get it all over the internet.
You'll at least hear a handful of new songs in a live set.
There you go.
We'll start with that.
All right, good. Big Sadie, Big Sadie Country Christmas is coming up Thursday night at the Hideout. The American Roots Band is bringing in the holidays with some special guests and a show at the Hideout. The album is called Keep Me Waiting. They are Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll get one more song here in Studio 435 from Big Sadie. Stay with us. All right, Studio 435 here on the download, Justin Kaufman. At 11 o'clock coming up here is Patty Vasquez. Studio 435 tonight, the band Big Sadie, American Roots Band, has a big show coming up at the Hideout on Thursday called Big Sadie Country Christmas. They're going to play with some special guests. They're going to bring out some hits. Not all holiday music. There'll be some other stuff as well. Big Sadie is Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown. Their album Keep Me Waiting is out. Talked about it when they came back here in May. All right, so we had some great stuff tonight. We're going to end Studio 435 with a classic. Here is Big Sadie with Let It Snow. Take it away, guys.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. Since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I hate going out in the storm. But if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbye. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Sadie in studio at Let It Snow. They are going to be on stage with the Big Sadie Country Christmas Thursday night at the Hideout, 1354 West Wabanzia. It's their big show to celebrate the holidays here in Chicago with a special guest that'll be coming through. Elise Bergman, Colin Moore, Andy Malloy, and Matt Brown in studio. They are Big Sadie again. They're going to be at the Hideout on Thursday night at the Big Sadie Country Christmas. You guys, I can't thank you enough for coming through again, performing, and thank you so much for bringing the holidays to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for the download. Patty Vasquez coming up with more Christmas fun. Man, the green room is packed.
Well, they are now in the cafeteria. The Chicago Clarinet Ensemble are in the cafeteria rehearsing, so they would not have any sort of bleed through with.
Oh, I love it. There's so many clarinets here.
I
went out into the hallway.
I think one time they had like 26 at one point.
There were a lot of people out there with cases. Now maybe there's not all. Maybe there are no clarinets in those cases, but it seemed like there were clarinets.
We have had a full studio before. Yes, security called me on my way here. They're like, there are quite a few people in the lobby here for your show. We don't have them all on the list. I was like, I've never made a list.
Yeah, there's no list. What are you talking about?
Yeah, they just show up.
If they have a clarinet, let them in.
That's right. Exactly. I think that should be the standard rule. And one of the reasons that we have a clarinetist is because we have so many musicians on our show as well. Yeah. And every time I would ask an artist what was their first instrument, they would say a clarinet, right?
Love it, yep.
But we had never had a clarinetist on the show. So my producer at the time, Craig Collins, went out and found an entire group only played clarinets. So there you go.
That's amazing to have a clarinet ensemble. You got your work cut out Ferguson, right?
Oh, he always does.
He's a lot of clarinets to mix.
He has much experience with this crowd.